Welcome. Could you all please be seated? We're ready to start. We have a quorum. I call this special town meeting to order. I declare a quorum present and find in order the return of service, the call of the meeting, and confirmation of timely mailing of the warrant to the residents. Let's see. Mr. Woodard, I normally ask Mr. Keller. The selectmen are still meeting. So, Mr. Woodard, would you kindly move to dispense with the reading of the call of the meeting, the officer's return of service, and the reading of the article in the warrant? All you have to do is say, so moved.
I can handle it. So moved.
Is there a second? Second, yes. Anybody wish to be heard on dispensing with these matters? I see none. It got a second. All those in favor, raise your cards. All those opposed, it is unanimous. We will have a motion and a presentation. By an employee of Minuteman Tech, it is Cami Lamica, who is the business manager at Minuteman. Please make a motion.
I move that the town hereby approves the sum of $725,000 of borrowing authorized by the Minuteman Regional Vocational Technical School District for the purpose of paying costs of a feasibility study to consider options for making improvements to the district's high school building located at 758 Merritt Road, Lexington, Mass., which options shall include, but not be limited to, renovating, reconstructing, expanding, remodeling, and adding to the district's high school or any combination of the foregoing, said sum to be expended at the direction of the school building committee. The Massachusetts School Building Authority's grant program is a non-entitlement discretionary program based on need as determined by the MSBA, and any costs of the project that the district incurs in excess of any grant approved by and received from the MSBA shall be the sole responsibility of the district, and that the total amount of the borrowing authorized by this vote shall be reduced by any grant amount set forth in the feasibility study agreement that may be executed between the district and the MSBA.
Thank you very much. Does it receive a second? It does. Ms. Lamica, for a presentation, please. You have 10 minutes.
Okay. Good evening. Dr. McQuillan, the superintendent of Minuteman, was unable to be here this evening and is at another member town meeting. We haven't found a way to get him in two places as of yet, but we've come close with this brief video.
One of the things that we do here very well is make sure that we push the students to not only achieve what we know they're capable of, but what they don't know they're capable of.
It's a hands-on learning situation, and I'm a very hands-on technical kind of teacher. I like to do experiments. I like my students to do experiments.
It's not easy. It is challenging. But as long as you work hard, you'll do fine here.
Everything happens at Minuteman. Every single filter that happens in the real world, I like to think that we take the kids through that. We're their lens to understanding the world.
They're working as a professional, whether it be cosmetology, whether it be carpentry. They're doing the hands-on activities that they'll be asked to do in the field.
I want to make sure that I have a background knowledge of my career. So when I go to college, I know what's going on and how I'm going to take my next steps.
One of the things the school does a good job with is advisory committees. We go out and bring in partners from industry.
What we're trying to do here at Minuteman is really create a high-performance learning environment that's going to serve kids in high school, young adults, as well as the itinerant workforce in the area. Minuteman has over 200 employers that are on our advisory committee. By law, we're required to have an advisory committee composed of business people, employers, parents, post-secondary partners, and those folks have been very involved in our strategic planning over the last 18 months. We have 9 high schools in our 16 towns. And, you know, when you look at the investment of those 9 high schools and totaled it up, it's close to $500 million that has been spent in our member towns on their high schools over the last 20 years. And during that same period of time, there has been zero invested in Minuteman, in its infrastructure, in its capital needs. All we've been doing is repairing things. We need to address that now.
Feasibility does nothing more than determine the scope of the project. We need to take a look at this building, along with the MSBA, with a project manager, to understand exactly what is needed. And when you know the scope and you know the various opportunities of scope, you can then determine the cost.
What we expect to get out of the feasibility study is more detailed analyses of the current conditions, some ideas about renovation, and some firm costs about what a renovated Minuteman would be. There'd be no financial impact in FY11 of your approval of this feasibility article. That impact would begin in FY12. And each individual town has been given that information detailing what that impact would be. Our cost of $725,000 would be borne by all 16 towns. Because of our regional agreement, we require and are asking for a unanimous vote from all 16 towns to move forward with this feasibility invitation. The state has agreed to pay 40% of that $725,000. Their commitment to Minuteman is clear. What is not clear yet is our commitment from our 16 towns.
Minuteman definitely makes you think. They challenge you a lot.
It's given me some time to think about what I want to do.
It teaches you all different types of like learning styles. It also helps you.
It showed me my future and where I want to go in life.
I know I can make it, and that's my goal.
About green energy now.
As much as a third of the jobs in the future and careers in the future will be in the green technology, green area.
The economic stimulus dollars being provided by the federal government today are going to the creation of green jobs.
Thank you. That first beep was the 5 minutes, and you have whatever remains of your 10 minutes.
Okay.
Go right ahead. Oh, more?
Very quickly. Minuteman was invited to feasibility by MSBA in the fall of 2009. After filing our statement of interest with MSBA, they acknowledged our feasibility needs, leaping over many other districts who filed their statements. In July 2009, State Treasurer Tim Cahill announced the MSBA Vocational Renew and Repair Program that will provide $100 million for improvements to vocational, technical, or agricultural schools that have pending statements of interest filed with MSBA. Minuteman was named as one of the 9 regional districts. This slide shows the very involved process with MSBA. Minuteman is currently in phase 1, obtaining the local town meeting votes to approve our feasibility study indicated by the red circle. What is the feasibility study, you might ask? This study is a robust analysis of the existing building, performed in part by an architectural firm in partnership with the MSBA. The study will determine the current physical capacity and constraints of the existing building and site. Why do we need a feasibility study? Any school repair, renovation, or construction project seeking MSBA funding is required to perform a feasibility study in partnership with MSBA. MSBA needs to be a full partner in the study process to ensure all avenues have been examined before they invest taxpayers' dollars in any approved project. MSBA will not accept feasibility studies completed by the school district alone. What's different about Minuteman's feasibility study? Having 16 town creates some complexity. We are part of the Vocational Repair and Renew Program commitment from MSBA. Some feasibility study components have been completed as part of our ESCO project. Enrollment issues are complex. Our out-of-district enrollment presents opportunities. Our communities have specific concerns, thinking outside the box when it pertains to the model of delivery. And at the same time, we also have a task force comprised of individuals from our member towns reviewing the regional district agreement document. How is the $725,000 amount determined? This is the budgeted maximum amount. This amount includes the designer services required to perform the majority of the study work, as well as the owner's project manager's fee. The owner's project manager is required to be contracted with prior to us selecting and beginning work with the designer. The impact of no feasibility study would mean Minuteman would continue to pay for smaller capital maintenance items from our budget. This is a slow process with approximately $300,000 being spent annually. There would be no MSBA reimbursement to our member towns for the cost of improvements. And some items are too costly for our current budget, such as the 24-year-old roof needing to be replaced with estimates approximately $2.8 million. Sudbury's portion of the total cost of the $725,000 feasibility study is $10,345 over a five-year period beginning in fiscal 12, next fiscal year. Sudbury's portion represents approximately 2.3% of the net amount after the MSBA reimbursement of 40%.
Thank you very much. Finance Committee, have a recommendation?
Finance Committee recommends approval.
Finance Committee recommends approval. Selectmen?
The Selectmen recommend approval.
The Selectmen also recommend approval. Anybody wish to be heard on this article? It's the only article in the special town meeting. I see no hands. We'll go right to a vote then. The motion is before you on the view graph. All those in favor of the motion signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It is a unanimous vote. It passes. Mr. Keller, do I have a motion to dissolve the special town meeting to be followed immediately by the continuation of our annual town meeting?
Move in the words of the moderator.
Is there a second? There is. All those in favor of the motion signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it is unanimous. We will now move on. Before we open on Article 5, a few words. We're now in the annual town meeting, so I must call this meeting to order. My name is still Myron Fox, and I'm still honored to preside at the annual town meeting. I declare a quorum present. Coffee and snacks are being provided this evening by the Loring PTO. Please remember to turn off all your cell phones so it's not confused with our five-minute warnings. Please give your name and address each time you speak in order to assure a clear record. If you desire to be recognized, just raise your card from your seat, and the runners will bring you a mic. The mic will already be turned on. You're not allowed to call out because you wish to speak. You have to be recognized by me. The only three exceptions to that rule are if you want to call the question, If there's a point of order, and we went over the only three circumstances under which you can make a point of order last night. And the third way you can speak and interrupt either me or a speaker is if you have a point of privilege, which is also limited. So if I know some of you had questions about town meeting procedure. Unfortunately, the town bylaw does not permit me to have a recognized list of speakers. So if you want to make an amendment, if you have a question and you come up to me before town meeting and say, could you call on me, I can't guarantee that because of the way the bylaw is written. But if you're patient and you raise your hand, I hope to be able to get to you. All motions to amend must be delivered to me, the town clerk, and the staff at the Viewgraph in writing before they are made to the hall. Only registered voters of the town and non-resident town employees and regional school employees may speak without leave of the hall. All non-residents are required to sit in the last two rows to the left and the right in the back of the hall. Please remember that our bylaw require presenters to speak for no more than a total of 10 minutes and speakers for no more than a total of 5 minutes. There is hope among many of you that we finish up this town meeting tomorrow night. It's going to be very close. If a fortnight is necessary, it will be in 6 days on Monday. Unless you move in the words of the article as printed in the warrant, every presenter must tell the hall of any word changes in the motion and how they differ from the words that the voters saw in the warrant. Please remember, there'll be no hissing, booing, whistling, clapping, or the like before, during, or after anyone is speaking. It'll be a majority vote on every article unless it's announced or written in the warrant otherwise. Anybody who needs a warrant can pick one up in the front. If it's not convenient for you to come forward, please raise your hand now and we'll have the Boy Scouts bring you a warrant. Anybody need a warrant? Raise your hand high. Can the Boy Scouts, Patty, do the Boy Scouts have the warrants up front here? Over here, can you come here, please? Can you be kind enough to hand them out? Could you raise your hand, sir, and he'll bring you one? Anybody else need a warrant? Nope, that's the only one. Oh, another one here? Great, just keep your hand raised. Mark, you need a warrant? Okay. Bathrooms are across the hall from the floor of the auditorium. Fire exits are both rear doors and both stairs leading to the stage. If you go through this, come up this exit during an emergency, you just walk behind the curtain and go out to your right. The Boy Scouts microphone runners are from Troop 63. Tonight we have Remington Chin. Could you raise your hand? Remington's over here. And Rick Rust, our warrant deliverer, is over there. Thank you both very much. Doug Cohen from the Capital Improvement Planning Committee is going to come to the front mic and give us a motion under Article 5. It's a little different than the article that appears in the warrant, so please look at it carefully on the screen.
Move to appropriate the sum of $529,054 for the purchase or acquisition of capital items, including but not limited to capital equipment, continuing payments of existing lease purchases, construction, engineering, design, and renovation to buildings, said sum to be raised by taxation, the sum of $50,000 to be immediately transferred and added to item 300. Sudbury Public Schools, net appropriated under the FY11 override and non-override columns voted under Article 4 FY11 budget, and to allow the purchase of equipment here under by entering into lease purchase agreements.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Cohen. Presentation.
The Capital Improvement Planning Committee's job is to take a long view on the town's assets and make sure that all the money that is invested in these assets is not wasted and that these assets are taken care of, in addition to making sure that we maintain a consistent level of services in the town. So what falls under our purview? It's assets that have a single-year cost of over $10,000 or multi-year cost of more than $100,000. And the way that our budget is determined is that all the department heads get together and provide a number of requests for capital purchases and capital items and submit them to the town manager, who then filters them through to our committee. And we evaluate them. We have a very in-depth set of conversations and hearings with the department heads. And then we whittle that down to what the actual budget is, which is based on a growth percentage from the previous year. So in 2010, the budget was $523,383, and with a 1.1% growth rate, that translates into $529,054 for the non-override budget. Starting in last year, in FY010, we made the decision to transfer years 2 through 5 of ongoing capital leases into the capital budget. They had previously been in the operating budget, and it was causing a lot of distress for a lot of the department heads because they'd make a purchase, and then in the year 2, they'd all of a sudden have this big lease payment. We didn't think it made sense for that to happen. So as of last year, and again in FY11, we decided to approve the years 2 through 5 of all of the capital leases. I should mention that when we lease these vehicles and other things, it's a 5-year capital lease, at the end of which we own the vehicle, and then the vehicle stays in service for 15 years, 20 years. So although it's a 5-year lease and you see that dropping off, the vehicles that are being replaced are often 15 years old, 20 years old. So we unanimously voted to approve all of the ongoing leases, including the municipal tax software. And that the total for that was $255,783. The DPW requested 2 new vehicles. One of them is a tractor with a mower, and that is something that helps the quality of life. It helps trim the hedges on the sidewalks. And the other vehicle was a sweeper. This is something that has both a quality of life as well as an economic benefit. Currently, the DPW contracts out sweeping of the streets, so this enables us to use less of those services, but also to be able to provide that service whenever it's requested as opposed to when the contracting is available. And these are both 5-year leases, and the total for them is $54,500 per year, and so that would be the amount that we approved for this year. And we also voted to approve both of these purchases. And I should mention that we're at somewhat of a stable rate in terms of ongoing leases. So the new vehicles that are added are somewhat replacing other vehicles that are being fully paid for. The next set of requests are related to building facilities, and we grouped a number of different departments here together because they're all related to some of the larger assets of the town. From the Parks and Rec Department, we had a request for the building renovation at the Fairbanks Center and including asbestos removal. The request was for $42,000, and the committee voted to approve that request. There was also a request to redo the pool house women showers for $25,000, and the committee voted not to approve that, not because it wasn't seen as a valid project, but rather that we wanted to give the building manager flexibility to do that project or other projects as they might come up. And that leads me into the next line item, which is various building improvements. That was requested for $35,000, and we actually approved a higher amount, $58,771. And the reason being that the building manager is being asked to forecast his needs and his budget for, you know, a year and a half in advance, and we wanted to be able to give him the flexibility to change and adapt as the circumstances would dictate. So then the next request was for the senior center to replace the roof and skylight for $58,000. That's a project that's been kind of in need for a number of years, and we voted to approve that amount. And finally, there was a HVAC upgrade at the Fairbanks Center, $31,400. And again, that one we did not approve in the same vein of the pool showers to give the building manager the flexibility. Sudbury Public Schools had a request for $50,000. to fix the rooftop library HVAC and do a renovation, and the committee voted to approve that. So the total building and facilities related expenses were $208,771 that were approved. From some of the other departments, the police department requested a new live scan fingerprint system. The warranty is up on the old one, and it's somewhat outdated technology, so in the long run, it would end up costing the department a lot more if we didn't purchase the system, and so we voted to approve it. The fire department requested a radio generator for the Goodman Hill radio repeater site. It's our backup radio repeater, and I don't want to get into the specific details because I'm not the most knowledgeable person about this, but it's a backup generator to our backup radio repeater site. And ultimately, we felt that this was an expense that could be addressed in a much more cost-efficient way, so we voted not to approve it. Finally, there's an information technology request, which was to upgrade the DPW phone systems to voice over internet and then move their system to the firehouse for $35,000. This is a technology request, and when you look at the cost benefit, it had a 25-year payback, which is a lot for a technology request, and so we voted not to approve that. So finally, you can see here the summary. We had $616,683 in requests, and that was actually whittled down from the initial requests of over $1.1 million. We approved $529,054, which is exactly our non-override budget. And for the override, we voted to approve the same budget. We didn't feel that there were any pressing projects that would require additional override funds. And finally, as a quick editorial note, I will say that the CIPC unanimously voted to support the police department project. Obviously, this is something that needs to go to vote for the town, but having seen the presentations and having gotten a chance to tour the police headquarters personally, as well as seeing a lot of the requests that come in year after year that don't get approved to improve the headquarters of the police, like new windows and fixing the roofs, in the expectation that a new headquarters will be built, we all felt that this is a worthwhile expense and that now is the right time.
That's it. Thank you. Nice timing. Jim Rayo from the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of Article 5.
Larry O'Brien, Selectman.
Unanimous support from the Board of Selectmen.
Anybody wish to be heard on this Article 5? Yes, sir. Can you stand up, please? Can you come around front and give this gentleman a mic? Thank you.
Adam Miller, Knobscot Road. I'm just wondering, in your presentation, you talk about the non-override and override budget being the same. In our warrant, it's printed, there's a $2,000 difference. I just want to know how that would account.
Yeah, so the original amount that we voted on was the $529,054. And then as the warrant was being printed, I think there was an expectation that the state aid would come in lower than expected. But that expectation has been revised. And that reflects a lot of the discussion that we had yesterday, which showed a revised budget. So ultimately, our original non-override and override budget were the $529,000. What was printed in the warrant was with the expectation of a reduction in state aid on the non-override side.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 5? Yes, sir. Over on the aisle, please. Right over there. Stand up, please.
Hi, my name is David Gardner. I live on Tavern Circle. I just have a question. The capital, I only saw one item in there for the Sudbury schools. Do the both school systems have their own capital budgets that are separate from this? Or do they come here and request only when they have special cases?
Lincoln Sudbury has their own separate capital budget.
Do you know the answer to the question? Chuck?
Lincoln Sudbury, the regional high school has a separate capital budget.
Their own. And how about SPS?
I don't believe SPS does. That's why we transferred the
$50,000. It's part of the town. SPS is part of the town. LS is not.
Right. And there was one request for the SPSS.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Can you bring the mic to this gentleman over here in front?
Mr. Moderator, Hank Surratt, Longfellow Road. To the extent that this article seeks $10,000 for police technology that should better be acquired by sharing it with our surrounding towns, I ask to oppose this article. This town should not have duplicative government, where we duplicate once again everything that every one of our surrounding towns has. We'll get to the police palace later, but it seems to me that in order to provide our services efficiently, we should outsource things like color scanning or fancy scanning of fingerprints. Virtually all of the prisoners taken into the Sudbury Police Station who are held are transported to the Framingham District Court. It makes no sense to have, once again, redundant and duplicative forms of government.
Thank you. Did you want to respond?
Yeah, I can appreciate your concern. I had the same questions for the chief of police when we went to go talk to him about this. And you know what was explained to me is that you're going to be robbing Peter to pay Paul, or whatever the phrase is. You know, a police officer is going to have to take a prisoner when they book them in all the way over to Wayland's police station or to Framingham's police station and stay with them the whole time. So what you're talking about is an officer spending anywhere, you know, from an hour to 2 hours or 3 hours to book a prisoner, because we don't have the ability to do it within Sudbury, which means that then you're talking about needing additional staffing or being short-staffed on these things. So the way it was explained to me, which I agree with and I understand, is that that is a valid concern. However, it's a choice between increasing your operating budget and having more headcount or paying overtime or having this type of technology.
Yeah. Anybody else wish to be heard? Second gentleman out there.
Philip L. Connors, 33 Dudley Road. I say we support, I certainly do, the $10,000 on that police request. I was a police chief for many years in Ayer, Massachusetts, and the cost, if it was tried the way this gentleman in front of me said it, just as just been explained, would cost much more than saving $10,000. And I know there are some studies going on now to save some money. That's good. But I strongly support we go along with the $10,000. And Mr. Moderator, I would address the comment about the police palace.
No, that's not necessary. When we get to that, sir, I'll let you talk about that.
Okay, but I don't think we should allow someone to use a term like that.
The word palace is now stricken from the record.
Thank you.
And the elephant just left the room. Anybody else who hasn't spoken? Okay. We're ready for a vote then. All those in favor of Article 5, as you see on the view graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. It's well more than a majority vote, which is required. Article 5 passes. We're now moving on to Article 6. Mr. O'Brien for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. The motion that will be on the view graph is different from what is in your warrant. Move to amend Article 1, Section 2 of the Town of Sudbury bylaws by deleting the word April from the first sentence and substituting, therefore, the word May, and by deleting the words January 31 from the second sentence and substituting, therefore, the words last day in February, and to amend Article 2, Section 1 by deleting the words December 31 from the first sentence and substituting, therefore, the words January 31 preceding the annual town meeting, and to amend the first sentence of Article 4, Section 5 by deleting the word December and substituting, therefore, the word January in the first clause, and by deleting the word January from the second clause and substituting, therefore, the word February, and to amend the first sentence of paragraph 2 of Article 4, Section 5 by deleting the words February 28th and substituting, therefore, the words March 31st. And, Mark, do we have what the bylaw would look like? The amended? Do you have that?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. That was probably very confusing and difficult to follow. Essentially, that was all the legal mumbo-jumbo that was necessary to ask you to vote this evening.
Hang on.
Yes.
There's a motion on the view graph that you just saw. Is there a second to that motion? Thank you.
Yes, sorry, Mr. Moderator.
Yep.
Thank you for the second. That was the necessary legal language that would allow us to change the town's bylaws to essentially move the entire town meeting and related activities calendar back by 30 days. And that calendar includes when articles can be submitted, which right now is the end of December. It would slide back to the end of January. When the warrant is published, it would slide back 30 days. When town meeting convenes, rather than the first Monday in April, as we're doing now, the first Monday in May. The reason for all of this is essentially that over the last few years, the finance committee, the school committees, the board of selectmen, administrators, town manager, etc., have all discussed the fact that the budget cycle on Beacon Hill is not conducive to providing us with adequate numbers and information concerning state aid increases or decreases, and makes the budgeting process a little more difficult and sometimes a little bit of a guessing game. Last year, with the great difficulties that the state was having in projecting their revenue and the possibility of federal stimulus dollars, you'll recall that we delayed until June to approve our budget. Many, many, many years ago, those of you that recall the long-delayed budget between Mr. Finneran and Senate President Birmingham, they spent a lot of time out on the veranda smoking cigars and didn't settle a budget until October. We approved a budget that was at best iffy until the numbers finally came in and put us in a position where a special town meeting may have been required. This will not change the date of town elections due to the fact that town elections are coordinated on the same day with Lincoln and is brought together and is required as part of our regional agreement that concerns the high school. So that would be an ideal situation to move the town elections and coordinate that, but we will need to work that out with Lincoln, and we will undertake that effort. But this would be a first step to allow us to move back 30 days, and essentially the way the budget calendar works on Beacon Hill is that at the end of January, the governor produces his or her budget. Then at the end of February, the House releases their budget. And then at the end of April, the Senate releases their budget. On occasion, there have been resolutions where state aid for school aid, Chapter 70 and Chapter 90 dollars, have been agreed upon. Other years, there have not. And it creates great uncertainty. So we ask for your support just to allow the entire process to be pushed back. And the other great advantage is that there are many end-of-year activities that town and school staff have to undertake, and this is just another huge undertaking that, would, by pushing it back, would relieve some of the pressure on town and school staff.
Thank you. Bob Jenkinson, Finance Committee.
Finance Committee supports recommendation of this article.
Thank you. Any discussion in the hall? Yes, right there. Stand up, sir. Thank you.
Bill Maloney.
Yep, it's on.
Bill Maloney, Willis Road. I was involved in the region-wide elections many years ago, and I have a vague recollection, which may be erroneous, that the town elections had to be within a week of each town meeting in Lincoln and Sudbury. And that was why our meeting was a week after the elections and theirs was a week before. I could be dead wrong on this, but would you please check it?
Is anybody from LS know the answer to that question? Mr. O'Brien.
We have the answer. I just wanted to clarify with town council. The answer is that if you have one warrant, Mr. Maloney, you are correct, that if you have one warrant, and what we do is put the warrant for the town election and the town meeting warrant together as one document that you all have in your laps, then we must conduct the election within 1 week of the town meeting. By going to this format, we will incur an expense of approximately $2,000 additional dollars that would be the cost of producing and publishing the warrant just for the town elections, and then there would be the usual warrant that you have in your labs for town meeting. And if we go that route and mail the two separate warrants, the town elections and town meeting must be conducted within 35 days of each other. So town elections would stay the last Monday in March, and this movement would allow us to comply with the 35 days.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, right here, please.
Susan Uliano, 22 Jason Drive. I'm chair of the Sudbury School Committee. And I'd like to state that the Sudbury School Committee supports the motion on Article 6 as presented tonight. We believe that by moving the town meeting date and the other associated deadlines as described, that the budget process will be more efficient and more effective, and also we think the public will be better informed throughout the process. Our current process requires very early projections, both about expenses and revenue. State aid is really not the only revenue source that we have to track. Throughout the year, we also look at local revenues as they come in, as well as on the expense side, we're looking at utilities, special education, even our enrollment projections throughout the year. For example, we never quite know how many kindergartners are going to arrive the next fall, but we do a large outreach for our registration process in the spring. So as that process is evolving, we're required to present certain budgets along the way. In December, we have to vote a budget to turn into the town. Thus, we hold a budget hearing typically the first Wednesday in December, which is usually not well attended, and even those in attendance are told that this is a very preliminary projection and that the numbers were all changed in January and February. This year, I just want to note quickly, we tried an experiment to alter the process and improve the budget process within the confines of our current town meeting structure. And we appreciate the work in particular of the town staff. We were able to delay some of our projections. Like, we didn't produce layoff scenarios as early as we typically do, but it was very difficult because the budget schedule became very compressed. And so we learned that that was not necessarily the best way to address the issue. It would be much improved by actually moving the town meeting date. Now, of course, this won't solve all of our problems. We don't expect to know those state aid numbers finally, even by a May date. But we will know more, as we expect, both in the earlier stages of the process and as we head to town meeting. And we'll continue to work with the school committees, the finance committee, and the selectmen to fine-tune the process to address concerns like we have layoff notification requirements for our teachers and other aspects that we will need to continue to address.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. My name is Radha Gargaya. I live at 120 Powder Mill Road, and I'm the chair of the Lincoln-Sudbury School Committee. Lincoln-Sudbury School Committee could not take a formal position regarding this article, but it is my sense that we support any and all measures and which will actually help us and in getting a better definition about the finances. And as Ms. Susan Uliano just mentioned, I also urge Lincoln and Sudbury town officials to work closely with the LS school committee and the LS superintendent with regards to any possible teacher notifications. I also urge Lincoln and Sudbury town officials and the LS school committee to work together, as they have been doing, to coordinate LS regional high school finances.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard? Yes, sir, on the aisle.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. I'm the moderator of the Sudbury Water District. The Sudbury Water District conducts its annual meeting every year on the third Tuesday of May, And that is a date set by law. I believe it takes an act of the legislature to allow us to change that date. So I'm wondering if the selectmen would be willing to modify their motion to specify that no session of the town meeting will be held on the third Tuesday of May.
Mr. Coe, if I may interrupt, I don't think that's a problem because our bylaw still reads it goes Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, then the following Monday.
It's Tuesday. I said Thursday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's on the third Tuesday of May. So I'd like the selectmen to consider amending their motion to say that no session of the Sudbury Town Meeting will take place on the third Tuesday of May.
Mr. Cole, rather than amending their motion, would you accept it that it's a sense of the selectmen that they'll try not to do that? Is that okay with you?
I would certainly accept it if they say they will not do it and put it in the motion. I don't see any reason why it should be left to...
Mr. Coe, I would prefer not to amend the motion since it starts with the first Monday in May, and you are the third Tuesday, so that would be 3 weeks later. I would hope that town meeting would be concluded by then. I would think another option might be that the Board of Selectmen and the Water District talk about the possibility of bringing both meetings together and thus having a far greater audience for everyone to participate in all town business.
Well, that's not something that I can commit to. I mean, I'm not a commissioner. I have no control of that whatsoever. And anything that you did with respect to leaving that date free wouldn't preclude that at any time in the future. Our date is long predates this proposal and is set by law. And I believe that we have the prior claim, and I would like to see it specified that I would hope, too, that it doesn't run, that the Sudbury Town Meeting doesn't run that long, but history suggests that someday it might.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. Your question's been asked, you answered them, and they're not inclined to do that. So to just address your question just very briefly, excuse me a minute, to address your question briefly, town meeting would have to go 8 sessions. It would be very unusual. It never has in my tenure, and I don't remember it in Tom Dignan's tenure. Does anyone else wish to be heard on this article? Yes, ma'am.
Martha Cole, 14 Churchill Street. I move to amend the main motion by adding the following sentence. No session of the Sudbury Annual Town Meeting shall be scheduled on the same date as the annual Sudbury Water District meeting.
Excuse me. What's the point of order, please?
I have it.
Yes, that. No, thank you. Hank, finish the motion, please.
Oh, okay. The sentence is no session of the...
We got that part, just the end of it, please.
Okay, to follow the last sentence of Article 1, Section 2.
Thank you very much. Does that receive a second? Yes, thank you. I'm going to... you have 3 copies of that, Mrs. Coe? Great. Can you start with the view graph, please? That received a second. Anyone wish to be heard on this? We've heard. So you're ready for a vote on this amendment? I'm going to read it again just so you have it in front of you, even though it's not on the view graph quite yet because it'll take several minutes. To amend the main motion by adding the following sentence, no session of the Sudbury Annual Town Meeting shall be scheduled on the same date as the annual Sudbury Water District meeting. And that will follow the last sentence of Article 1, Section 2. All those in favor of this amendment signify by raising your cards. Thank you. All those opposed, it's overwhelmingly defeated. Anybody else wish to be heard on the main motion? I see no one. All those in favor of the main motion, I can't see. Please stand up. Thank you. Mark, can you put it back on the view graph?
Hi, my name is Madeline Gelsman, 520 Concord Road. My question is regarding the elections. Did they take over their positions 30 days after they're elected?
Anyone that is elected is sworn in at the close of the annual town meeting.
Thank you. Anybody else has a question or a comment? I see none. All those in favor of the main motion, as you see on the view graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes overwhelmingly. Article 7. Bob Jacobson for the Finance Committee.
Move to approve the sum of $271,437 for the Transfer Station Enterprise Fund for fiscal year 2011, and further to authorize use of an additional $29,595 of Enterprise Fund receipts for indirect costs, such sums to be raised by $250,000 in receipts and use of $51,032 of retained earnings of the enterprise.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Jacobson.
FinCom recommends approval of this article.
Thank you. Mr. O'Brien?
Board of Selectmen does the same.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 7? I see no one. If I miss you, please, you're allowed to shout out. All those in favor of the motion, as you see on the view graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than a majority. Article 8, Mr. Jacobson.
Move to approve the sum of $489,868 for the Pool Enterprise Fund for fiscal year 2011, such sum to be raised from $460,000 in receipts of the enterprise and use of retained earnings of $29,868 of the enterprise, and further to authorize the use of an additional $55,841 appropriated under account 900, fiscal year 11, town employee benefits for indirect costs.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Jacobson?
FinCom recommends approval of this article.
Mr. O'Brien?
Same from the Board of Selectmen.
Anybody wish to be heard? I see no one. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Passes almost unanimously. Article 9. Mr. Jacobson?
Fiscal Year 11 Recreation Field Maintenance Enterprise Fund Budget. Move to approve the sum of $221,497 for the Recreation Field Maintenance Enterprise Fund for fiscal year 2011, such sum to be raised from $221,497 in receipts of the enterprise.
It receive a second? It does. Mr. Jacobson?
Finance Committee is in favor of this article.
Mr. O'Brien?
Same from the Board of Selectmen.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 9? Yes, sir. Could you stand?
Robert Abrams, 24 Goodman's Hill Road. First problem I have with this is the way I'm looking at it in the warrant, this is the non-override sum, but if the override budget passes at the election, then it goes down to $187,769. That's what the warrant says. Is that going to happen under this article?
Yes, town manager.
Thank you. Under this article, if there is no override, if it does not pass, then we have additional costs that need to be covered. We would set the fees and raise them and spend them under the non-override budget, and so the appropriation covers that. Should the override pass, then some of those costs would be covered under the DPW budget. We would not need to spend at all. So the appropriation is still the limit, but the plans would be as shown in the warrant for the override amount. The appropriation covers both budgets, but we would not intend to set the fees to that level and raise them should the override be successful.
So then, if the override is successful, you're only going to spend $187,769 of the $221 appropriated?
Correct.
And what happens to the unexpended funds?
Enterprise funds work that any unexpended funds continue in that fund or available in future years. They would become retained earnings. As you saw from the prior budgets, for instance, for the transfer station, there were retained earnings that were used to support that, and those were funds from prior years.
So then the $221,000 is still tied up even if we don't spend it?
The $221,000 is the expectation of the fees that would be set by the Recreation Commission for this enterprise fund. Whenever we appropriate, that entity does not have to raise those fees necessarily. They may choose to spend only $100,000. The appropriation is the maximum that they can legally spend under an enterprise fund.
Thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 9? I see no one. All those in favor of the motion, as you see in the view graph, signify by raising cards. All those opposed, it passes unanimously. We're on to Article 10, unpaid bills. Barbara Chisholm, town accountant, for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move to indefinitely postpone consideration of Article 10.
Receive a second. It does. Ms. Chisholm.
There are no unpaid bills to report for FY10.
I want to tell you that is the best presentation of this annual. Mr. Jacobson, can you be equally succinct?
We wholeheartedly support Article 10.
Mr. O'Brien.
We concur.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 10, the motion to indefinitely postpone? There are none. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, it passes unanimously. Articles 11 through 13 were passed on the consent calendar. We're moving to Article 14. Mr. Keller, for a motion.
Move in the words of the article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Article 14 is the so-called local meals tax, excise tax. Folks may know that there is a meals excise tax that you pay when you go to a restaurant. It's presently 6.25%, and that goes to the state. The state has passed legislation that would allow that excise tax to be increased 0.75%, bringing it up to a total of 7%. And that additional revenue of 0.75% would go back to the town. So if we enact this, we will be, as a town, we will be the beneficiaries of that additional funding. It's a relatively small amount of money. If you spend $100 at a restaurant, it's 75 cents. But it does add up, and the DOR has estimated that over a 12-month period, Sudbury will receive an additional $88,000 in revenues, which, as I think we all know, our budget can use, and it can be well spent on the services that we receive in town. So the selectmen unanimously support the passage of this article.
Thank you. Joan Carlton for the FinCom.
The FinCom recommends approval of Article 14.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 14? Yes, over there. Could you stand, please?
Against taxes.
Tom Hollicker. 623 Concord Road. Will Sudbury bear any expense in the bookkeeping concerning this restaurant tax? Or is the bookkeeping entirely in the hands of the state?
The latter, entirely in the hands of the state. We will not incur any additional expense.
Thank you. Another gentleman, could you stand, please? And can you pass the mic to that gentleman, please?
I'm just wondering where this money winds up.
I'm sorry, you have to give your
name. I'm sorry. Glenn Merrill Skoloff, 18 Allen Place. I'm wondering where this money ends up. Does it go into the general fund? I mean, I saw that it's distributed quarterly into the general fund to be spent or allocated for the next year's budget, or does it become discretionary funds, or how does that work?
Yes, town manager?
You are correct. It would go into the general fund for FY11. No appropriations have been set or anticipated being requested for FY11 based on those funds, because until they really establish a pattern, the next year, it would be up to town meeting as to how to appropriate those funds. And, of course, we would bring recommendations, the finance committee, et cetera, as they do for all appropriations of town meeting. I think amongst ourselves, as we've discussed it would be great if we could start setting aside those funds for some of the unfunded liabilities that the town has, some of the savings needs that we have. But as you pointed out correctly, it just goes into the general fund at this time. Hopefully we're seeing it as sort of backstopping some of the things that have been uncertain, state aid, some of the others, provide just an extra layer of hopefully assurance that we will meet revenue targets in FY11.
Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 14? I see no one else. Yes, sir.
Bob Hardy, 37 Belcher Drive. I do not support this article. I think we already have a high enough tax. We have a split tax rate on our businesses here in Sudbury. which means they pay a higher tax rate than the residential commercial, the residential property tax rate. I think we need to be more supportive of our businesses in Sudbury and piling on these taxes, although this is not a big tax. It is a tax that we're piling on top of taxes that they already pay. And I think in this economy, we need to be a little bit more considerate of our businesses and not pile on more taxes. These are taxes that the consumers are going to have to pay. Businesses are going to have to charge. This may be a good idea in a good economy, but right now, raising additional taxes is not a good idea, and I do not support it.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on this article? Mr. Keller.
One point I neglected to mention in my presentation is that this has come before other towns in the area. It has already been accepted in the towns of Framingham, Wayland, Natick, Hudson, Maynard. It's also been adopted in the city of Boston, Cambridge, Brookline, Chelmsford, Newton, Bedford, Lexington, Wellesley, and Needham. So to the extent one is choosing a restaurant based upon the tax, I think that you're going to pay it, and we're going to have to pay it if we vote this.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, sir. Stand up, please.
Mr. Moderator, Hank Surrett, Longfellow Road. Although I am allergic to Republicans, I find myself opposing this article. This town needs to eliminate redundant government and regionalize functions like the police, the fire, and the DPW. We should not be building a moat around the town, though Mother Nature did give us one for a while. We can live within our means without additional taxes if we do away with our own police department and share that function with our surrounding towns.
Mr. Surrett, can we get to this local meals excise?
The point is, Mr. Moderator, we don't need the tax. We can, by using regionalization and efficiency, live within our existing budget. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 14? Could you stand up, please?
Kirsten Rapinian, Harness Lane. Just a question. I heard somebody just say that this was a tax on the business. Can you clarify for me whether this is a tax on the business or on the people that are actually eating at that particular establishment?
I think the gentleman who made the comment did say that the consumer would pay back the restaurant, and so it's the consumer who's paying it.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 14? I see no one. All those in favor of Article 14 signify by raising your cards. Keep them up, please. All those opposed? It's well more than a majority. It passes. Article 15, Mr. Keller.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move to accept Mass General Laws, Chapter 64G, Section 3A, allowing adoption of a local option room occupancy excise and to set the rate for the town of Sudbury's room occupancy excise at 6%.
To receive a second. It does. Mr. Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. We presently have a room excise tax. It is at 4%. It generates, in the past year, FY09, $58,000. The state has increased the amount that municipalities can set for their excise tax rate. It's been, under the statute, it's permitted to be raised to 6%. The suggestion here and the recommendation of the selectmen is that we enact this for Sudbury. It would generate an additional roughly just under $30,000 in taxes. We don't have very many hotels and inns, as we all know. The guests at the hotels and inns pay these taxes. If any of you stay in hotels and motels throughout the Commonwealth or throughout the country, especially in many other areas of the country, room excise taxes are well in excess of 6%, so I'd say that we're on, as a Commonwealth, we're on the lower end of this tax mechanism. I think it's and the selectmen believe it is not an unreasonable excise tax to enact. We urge your passage.
Joan Carlin for the FinCom.
Now, the Finance Committee recommends approval of Article 15.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 15? Yes, sir. Could you stand, please?
Thank you. Bob Hardy, 37 Belcher Drive. I also oppose this article for all the reasons I said last time. I'll also just add, We need businesses in town. They do not use a lot of services. They pay very high property tax rates. They are one set of taxpayers that we have in this town that pay an awful lot of money and don't use a lot of services. And we need those types of taxpayers in town. And I don't think adding more taxes to them is the right thing to do. So I think we need to support our businesses and make it easier for businesses to operate in Sudbury and attract and retain the commercial tax base that we have here, because it's very important to support the services that we have in town. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 15? I see no one else. All those in favor of Article 15 as shown in the V-graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes overwhelmingly. We now move on to Article 16. Larry O'Brien for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move in the words of the article.
Does it receive a second? Does it? Yes, it does. Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you. As the warrant article notes, this article authorizes but does not require or implement the creation of a consolidated public facilities maintenance function between the town and the Sudbury Public Schools Committee, although it could also include Lincoln-Sudbury Regional High School Committee should they decide to join in. This statute permits such consolidation if it is accepted by a vote of town meeting this evening and a vote of the Sudbury Public School Committee. At this time, no funding is being requested to create this new department or to hire a professional facilities manager, but your acceptance this evening of this statute allows for the planning to continue for such a future department to be developed. Over the course of the last 20 years, it's important to remember that the citizens of Sudbury have supported over $50 million, and the number goes to $120 million if you include the regional high school, worth of renovation, expansion, new construction in the form of school buildings, office space, our DPW garage, and the renovation and expansion of the Goodnow Library. Altogether, the town and SPS manage 25 buildings with almost 600,000 square feet and an insured value in excess of $60 million. Current staffing to manage these facilities for the town is provided by a combination of the town's building inspector and the building supervisor electrical inspector. The Goodnow Library is managed by the library director. The fire chief oversees his three stations. SPS has one maintenance director for five schools. On the town side, this arrangement is extremely decentralized and relies on staff for which building maintenance is not their primary responsibility and certainly not their areas of expertise. This position, as envisioned when created, this new department will care for all town and school-owned buildings under the control of the town manager and the Sudbury Public Schools superintendent. This new department will establish appropriate services in support of the building users, foster continuous improvement in delivery of services, and establish and update a five-year facilities capital improvement plan in collaboration with the Permanent Building Committee, the town manager, the SPS school superintendent, and other appropriate committees. This department will oversee all utilities of the town and school buildings, including contractual bidding out for oil, natural gas, and electrical utilities. The facilities director will work with the town's Green Ribbon Energy and Sustainability Committee to develop and implement energy-saving strategies for public buildings. The director will be responsible for developing and implementing a preventive maintenance program for all of our municipal and school buildings, as well as manage all town-owned rental buildings and houses. As noted before, this new department could be expanded to cover the Lincoln-Sudbury Regional High School as well. While discussion of consolidating facility management and maintenance has been going on for some time, this proposal emerged as the preferred model after the town manager and Sudbury Public Schools began work through a process known as CORE, and that acronym stands for Consolidation, Cooperation, Outsourcing, Regionalization, and Evaluation. Facilities maintenance and management and long-term planning was an area where both the town and school administration were convinced that improvements were needed. The current staffing model lacked the capacity to be strategic in thinking about how to manage these significant projects that would be needed in the future for the buildings, and that working together would likely generate the most efficient and effective solution. A task force of representatives from both town departments and the schools met, examined the current organizational structure, operations, staff, and expenditures, facility management, and focused particularly on energy costs and opportunities. Among their conclusions, one, facilities planning and operation and maintenance is now fragmented and decentralized and in need of a new focused vision from a trained professional facilities manager. Two, They found that a comprehensive preventive maintenance program in all buildings to extend the life of critical equipment and avoid costly repairs would be prudent. Three, that we could likely achieve savings by centralizing actions such as purchase of supplies and materials, development of centralized service contracts for HVAC, alarm systems, and other equipment. Four, they found that centralized attention to energy-related projects is important to reducing our utility costs and making our energy purchases as cost-efficient as possible. And five, that the town and schools need to develop a strategic master plan process for the capital improvements that the town and school buildings will need in the future. If you adopt this legislation, we can continue to study how to make this staff capacity help happen. Some have expressed concern that we don't need more administrative staff working for the town or schools. We understand that concern, but this is still a major missing piece as we look to be sustainable and to protect the town's assets and the significant investments that we have made over the last 20 years. The Board of Selectmen urge your support by voting yes on Article 16.
Joan Carlton, FinCom.
The FinCom recommends approval of Article 16.
Anybody wish to be heard on this article? Yes, sir.
Robert Abrams, 24 Goodman's Hill Road. The key words that I heard are that they're asking that we accept the statute now, and they're not asking for any money or any positions. So the negative pregnant is, after this town meeting votes to do this, and they're able to, then they're going to come back next year and say, now we need a new department, and we need a department head, and the department head's going to need an administrative assistant, and the department head and the administrative assistant aren't going to get their jobs done without a bunch of people. So they're sliding by without asking for anything tonight. The whole concept of creating a new department with a lot of people and a budget, and et cetera, et cetera. I respectfully suggest that we, the town meeting, say, come back to us when you're ready to come to us with both. Accept consolidation, and this is the amount of money we want for an administrator, an assistant, some staff, et cetera, et cetera. I would suggest that we vote against this now and have to bring the whole package, including how much it's going to cost us, to us at another town meeting. Thank you.
Anyone else wish to be heard? Yes.
Susan Giuliano, 22 Jason Drive, Sudbury School Committee. The Sudbury School Committee supports this article and has accepted the statute. As noted previously, consolidation pursuant to this statute requires acceptance both by town meeting and by a vote of the Sudbury School Committee, and we have so voted. This acceptance of this particular provision will facilitate the ongoing efforts between the town and the schools to consider how best to consolidate, coordinate, or share the functions of facilities management throughout the town. At this point, the staffing and operational plans are yet to be determined, but by adopting this provision, that provides the greatest flexibility for the town and the schools to, in the future, come back with the most efficient and effective staffing model, and certainly any budget requests will be, you know, submitted for future town meeting vote. At present, the Sudbury Public Schools has one person who provides all of the facilities management and hands-on maintenance work for all five buildings. Town staff provides grounds work for the buildings, so at present we already do coordinate to a great extent. But acceptance of this article will enhance our ability to consider going forward how to consolidate and more effectively provide this service to the town.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard? Yes, sir. Could you stand? Can we bring this gentleman a mic? Right in front would be best.
Paul Pegas, 231 Oscar Road. Since the article's before town meeting, somebody must have some projections. What's it going to cost, and what are we going to save? Can somebody come up with some tentative figures?
Thank you. Town manager?
We had put together a figure originally for a facilities director. That was not supported by the finance committee or as it went through the budget process for that. I think we were looking at a budget. I don't have it in front of me because it was polled about 110, 15,000, something along those lines for a facilities director and an administrative assistant. We understand the challenge in terms of adding new positions and doing all of that. We don't have more specific data in terms of what we assume the savings will be from energy and other types of benefits that can be put in place. We only can see what the other towns have accomplished in that, and again, that always depends on where they're starting from. If they've done no energy efficiencies, they have huge savings. If they've done some, there's less savings already. So I don't have a projection for that, but that is the budget we'd originally put together for this combined department.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, could you stand up, please, sir?
Brian Semple, 15 Revere Road. I just cannot believe that we would consider doing this and actually hiring more people into the town government. We have a structural deficit. We have significant issues with trying to make the budget each year. I just voted to raise the meal tax, $88,000, to try to keep more teachers. Yet we're even proposing to add more headcount into the government to do this. I completely support doing this. It makes a ton of sense that we should combine the two groups. I understand from the school committee standpoint, we have to agree to it, and then the school committee has to agree to it. Can we get the commitment from the town manager or selectman that we will not add people to make this consolidation happen?
Town manager?
I'm not sure I let the selectman speak on that in terms of that, but I think in terms of moving together now, moving forward with this now, it allows us to explore within existing resources how we can better consolidate. It's an interesting just fact between the schools who have bottom line authority and the town, which is a very different one, to try to work together. So even if we tried to look at could we combine and share our current facilities people, we don't really have a structure mechanism to do that. So I can't, I'll let again the selectmen talk about what their plans would be for the future, but this would allow us, without even looking at additional resources at this point, talk about how we can better share and work together with what we have.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard?
Could I do a follow-up question?
Yes.
Or comment? This just seems overly complex. It's building management, it's five facilities. In the private sector, we do it quite often. I wish we could just hear you say, no, we're not going to hire anybody, and then I think it's an easy thing to do, and I think you probably get the hall to vote for it immediately. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone from a different section, we haven't heard from yet. Yes, sir, could you stand, please? Can you bring it around front?
Don Hutchinson, 15 Pendleton Road. I would like to suggest...
Could you hold the mic a little closer to you and your name, sir?
Don Hutchinson, 15 Pendleton Road. I'd like to suggest that consideration be given to outsourcing this combined department.
Thank you. Anyone else who hasn't spoken? We'll get to people who have spoken in a minute. Could you stand, sir? The mic over there.
Matt Copeland, 17 Oak Ridge Road. I just want to clarify the intent. I'm a little bit confused between what Brian mentioned and what you were saying. Originally, it sounded less like consolidation and more like creation of a new department, and then it followed up. It made a lot of sense saying that it might be helpful to have a structure to rearrange the existing people. So if it's something that you're envisioning as a budget-neutral solution where we may hire somebody, we may not, that, I'm not so concerned about that, but if we hire somebody, I would expect some cuts in a different area because they are obviously not needed anymore. So I just maybe wanted a little more clarification on the intent of what the next year would be spent doing until you come back and ask for more money.
Is that the selectman wish to answer that or the town manager?
You want to answer first.
Okay.
I think it would be... in the short term, without any extra dollars or staff, we're going to look at what we can do with what we currently have and see how that works out. Again, because these are elected bodies that make those decisions, that's not up to me as town manager to say. But I would say for this year, if this passes, it gives us the legal foundation to begin looking at how we can put this together. If we never have more resources, we still have to look at how we can work together to get this work done. We truly are both doing more on the town side than on the school side, but not doing a great job right now. I'll give an example. I hope I don't embarrass Nancy McShay, our recreation director, but when she brought the project for the floor in Fairbank, we said, what would you do in Wayland with this? She said, I'd send an email to the facilities manager and it would be taken care of. Right now, it's a major project she's got to do all the work on. So it's just we need to take a look at what resources we have and how we can work together. The town could have done this on our own and just looked at town buildings without bringing this to town meeting. But our intent is to say, how can we work and collaborate with Sudbury Public Schools on something to look at a joint and shared approach? I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the intent of where we're trying to go.
Okay. Anyone who hasn't spoken? Yes, the gentleman way back there.
Stuart Lovell, 58 Hudson Road. This is a quite extraordinary article. I've only ever worked in the private sector. It's an absolutely extraordinary notion that somebody would propose to do something without having any concrete answer to the question of what's it really going to cost. I move to amend the article to read, establish a budget...
Sir, you can't make a motion to amend in the middle of a speech.
Okay.
So if you want to, you can finish your speech, and maybe if you're called on again, you might be able to make a motion to amend.
Okay. Thank you. We've heard, you know, just clues about what the town manager knows here. There's maybe a couple of $100,000 of expenses here, which she's already seen, but which then just got hidden back in the cupboard somewhere. And I can only reiterate that it's an extraordinary proposition that we'll simply do this, and then we'll find out what it costs. I would propose that I sell my house to Sudbury, and once we've agreed the contract, I'll tell you what the price is going to be.
Write it out, and if you're called on again, well, hand it over here, and we'll look at it. Yes, no, this gentleman right here hasn't spoken. Yes, sir. No, fine, you're next.
Dandy Pompey, 35 Haynes Road. You've also succeeded in getting me very confused. Is there a statute right now or some law that says the selectman and the town manager can't talk to the public schools or Lincoln Sudbury about opportunities to save in consolidation? I mean, I agree with what Mr. Semple said. In business, when you consolidate, you get together and you talk, and you determine whether or not in a consolidation you're going to save money. And if it looks like you're going to save money, then you get all the help you need in reducing facilities and reducing people. But the question is there something right now that stops us from talking to each other about consolidation? Thank you.
Thank you. This gentleman was next, right behind you.
You want to answer that?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Mr. Keller.
I'd like to address that point, and this actually is the result of talking and communicating that was going on. We in this town have quite a number of buildings. If you look around, we have three elementary schools, the middle school, the high school. Those buildings are managed, so to speak, by the sort of senior person in the building. Often it's a principal as part of the part-time work that he or she does. They manage the building in addition to doing the educational responsibilities. Same thing happens on the town side. The fire chief does a nice job of managing the fire station. The police chief has a much tougher job trying to maintain the police station. And various buildings around town, the senior center, the recreation facility, the pool facility, all of them are being maintained, I don't want to say haphazardly because it's not haphazardly, but they're being maintained by people who are not trained in maintaining facilities and buildings. In the private sector, when a corporation or company grows, they might start out with a building or two and someone's assigned the job to maintain the building for a while. When they grow to the point when they've got 25, 30, 40 buildings, I can assure you, I'll let you decide for yourselves, do you think they continue to manage those buildings part-time by the people who happen to be doing the work, the other work they're trained to do in that building, or does the company bring in a trained facilities manager to maintain all of the buildings owned by that corporation? I think it's the latter. I think that's what is done, and that's what we are trying to do here. We're trying to set up the mechanism. Ultimately, will need to be funded. That is true. Where is that funding going to come from? Well, you folks sitting at town meeting, after getting recommendations from your finance committee, are going to decide how that's going to be funded. Part of that funding, I would project, I'm not going to have a say in it, but I would project some of that money will probably come out of the SPS budget, existing budget. Some will probably come out of the LS budget, existing budget. Some of that money will come out of the existing town budgets. And maybe that'll be enough. Maybe there'll be savings that'll be generated by this activity. Maybe a lot of things. But that's not what we're being asked to decide tonight. We're being asked to set up a mechanism to plan better and to manage our town facilities better. That's what you're being asked.
The question has been called. Before I take a second on the question, I'd just like to, the gentleman who tried to make an amendment. I would not have accepted the amendment because you're trying to establish a budget not to exceed $88,000, and there's no appropriation called for in it, so it's outside the four corners of the article. So it's not been made. Had it been made, I would have declared it out of order. Is there a second to the call of the question? There is. Who wished to speak and offer some new information but for the call of the question? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm going to entertain the call of the question, but first I'm going to do something I don't normally do, which is to call on this gentleman right here who I called on before and someone else jumped up and started talking. So this gentleman will speak, and then we'll have the call of the question.
Rami Alwan, 119 Pantry Road. I'm very much in favor of this. I think that this is a good idea. I think that it will facilitate maintaining buildings in the town. I've been working with others on the Green Commission, and we're never quite sure who to ask when we want to look at how we might do some solar project somewhere or how we might want to do something, because there's not really, but as Ms. Valenti said, there's nobody sort of really in charge in that way. The one thing that is concerning to me, and I've seen it twice in the article, and Mr. Keller just spoke to it, is how would, and I'm open to suggestions, how would Lincoln Sudbury Regional High School be incorporated into this? We've heard the town speak, we've heard Sudbury Public Schools speak. At the moment, for the maintenance department at LS, I think 17% of their salary is being paid for through Lincoln. Does that mean that 17% of the time they're going to help out in Lincoln? That's confusing to me. The other one is the LS maintenance is not unionized, where Sudbury is, with a very different salary scale and a much nicer benefits package. So I am concerned about the dollar figures in that way, should LS be brought into this. I'd entertain something, so that's more of a question, and I'd like to hear from the LS school committee or from someone who has some answers to that. Thank you.
Hang on. Given the call of the question, I'll allow a 30-second answer, and then we're going to go to the call of the question.
Okay. Thank you. I may have partially misspoke as I gave my answer before, because the LS is not actually a part of this proposal tonight, but the mechanism is being set up so that it can join in the proposal as well. The intent is to manage all of our buildings, and the budgetary details that you point out in terms of the Lincoln and Sudbury portions of the budget, those are details that will be worked out if LS joins in the joint facilities management for the facility at the high school.
Thank you. The question has been called. We're now going to take a vote. Keep in mind that there are five people who wish to speak. All those in favor of the call of the question signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It fails. It needs two-thirds. Anybody else wish to be heard on the subject? Ma'am, right there.
Laura Abrams, 24 Goodmans Hill Road. Could town council please read to us, because I'm guessing it's not as brief as this, could you read us MGL 7137M so we know exactly what we are voting on? I mean, it just says consolidation of the facilities. Why am I thinking that the law is not that simple?
Town council does not have a copy of the statute with him. Excuse me? Oh, you have a copy? Council Giuliano has a copy of it.
and she's about to tell us what it says. How long is it? Please read it. Thank you.
Susan Giuliano again. Chapter 71, Section 37M, Consolidation of Administrative Functions with City or Town. Notwithstanding the provisions of Chapter 41 or Chapter 71 or any other special or general law to the contrary, any city or town which accepts the provisions of this section may consolidate administrative functions, including but not limited to financial, personnel, and maintenance functions of the school committee with those of the city or town, provided, however, that such consolidation may occur only upon a majority vote of both the school committee and, in a city, the city council, with approval of the mayor required by law, or in a town, the annual town meeting, or in a town with no town meeting, the town council. This is Section B. Notwithstanding any general or special law to the contrary, a decision to consolidate functions pursuant to paragraph A of this section may be revoked by a majority vote of either the school committee of the city or town, or the city or town, or both, as such vote is described in said paragraph A.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, sir. Could you stand, please? Can we bring a mic down in front, please? Never mind. Too quick.
Bruce Langer, 9 Benbrook Road. Some years ago, I was for many years a member of the Permanent Building Committee. What I'm going to say is my own personal opinion, but I can tell you from experience on that committee, there are many a time we wished there was a single entity to do the maintaining of the buildings, because we saw some buildings deteriorating far more than they would have under a single guidance. We already have spent money on repairing buildings that should have been taken care of before, that we didn't have to spend if we had had single party and a coordinated effort on doing this. I look at this as a move to save money and consolidate in the future and in the long term.
Thank you. Yes, this gentleman hasn't spoken. Could you stand, please, and can we get a mic into the middle of that aisle? No, yes, just gentleman here, yes. Could you get the mic? Thank you. Oh. Yes, sir, go right ahead.
Dave Livingston, 155 Knobscot Road. I'm in favor of this motion. When I read it in the warrant, it looked to me as if something had been developed by the Budget Review Task Force.
Sir, could you hold the mic a little closer?
This looked like a motion developed by the Budget Review Task Force because it doesn't look to me as if it would necessarily cost money, but would it enable the town and the schools to reorganize in a more efficient way. I don't think we should look on it as an expenditure. Any expenditures that would be necessary would have to come to town meeting. It enables some of the planning that's been recommended that the schools, that both school systems and the town have been working on.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak? Anyone who hasn't spoken before? Over there, please. That's fine. Could you stand up, please? No, there's someone right behind you. Thank you.
Hi, Nancy Weatherby, Marlborough Road. I have a question, and it's a follow-up from that gentleman's question regarding the Lincoln-Sudbury Regional High School. Reading in the financials, it looks like LS has approximately $600,000 of maintenance fees. I'd like to understand what percent of the entire Sudbury budget does LS Lincoln-Sudbury actually comprise for maintenance. I'm concerned that if we move forward just on Sudbury alone, and we don't encompass and bundle in the maintenance associated with LS, that we may be, you know, it may take us two steps to get there instead of one. So I'd like if, maybe Chuck, if you could give us some guidance on what percent of the entire maintenance budget LS actually constitutes.
So what percentage of the LS budget, of the LS maintenance budget is
would
to
fall what, under this?
Would fall under this. I think the answer is right now zero.
Zero.
Under this proposal.
No, if under this proposal, considering that if we were to true consolidate, it's my recollection that when we voted in the interim superintendent, the definition of interim was so that we could see whether or not we could consolidate LS with Sudbury. I haven't heard much of the follow-up because there was going to be a considerable cost savings involved in that. We have an interim superintendent so that some of these issues could be straightened out over the next 3 years. And I think that this is part of that entire conundrum of whether or not Lincoln Sudbury should be absorbed into the Sudbury school system and also the Lincoln school system.
Thank you very much. Is that the answer, that LS is not part of this right now?
A couple of things. First of all, I don't think anybody ever talked about absorbing LS into the Sudbury school system. I think there was a recommendation to consolidate the administrative functions, which is, to me, a very different thing. So we don't have two superintendents, correct. And I think we heard from Mr. O'Brien last night on the status of that effort. In this case, I think we're talking about ultimately consolidating the management of the maintenance of the buildings, and as a first step, they want to look at doing it within the town, which means that the town buildings and the Sudbury Public School buildings. Legally, we don't have the right to incorporate LS into this kind of arrangement because it's a separate legal entity. That would be something you might do down the road. I think you were maybe asking, all right, if we do get there down the road, what percentage of the entire townwide, including LS maintenance function, lies with LS? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. I mean, LS is about 25% of our total budget, but I'm not sure if you added up the maintenance dollars in each section of the budget, what their proportion would be.
Okay. Is there anyone here who hasn't made up their mind on how to vote on this issue? Could you raise your hand if you haven't made up your mind yet? Mr. Seppel, you haven't made up your mind yet? There's one person in the audience.
I have one question that I'll make up my mind.
Nice try. Is there anyone else who hasn't made up their mind? You haven't. Mr. Coe, you haven't made up your mind yet? So there's two people, three people. Anybody else? Okay. I'll leave it up to the audience. Do you want to keep going, or do you want to move? The question has been called. Is it seconded? It is. This is a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of the call of the question signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. This time it passes overwhelmingly by more than a two-thirds margin. The motion is in front of you in the view graph. It's pretty short. We're going to have a vote on it now. All those in favor of the motion, as you see in the view graph, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than the required majority. Article 17. Andrea Turkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move in the words of the article.
To receive a second. It does. Ms. Turkelson.
Thank you. Passage of this article allows the town to raise the fee for each written demand of delinquent taxes from the existing $5 to $10. Massachusetts General Law Chapter 60, Section 15, recently increased the limit from $5 to $30. We're required to issue demand fees, and as part of that, we'd like to increase the fees to cover the increased costs to send out those demand bills. And that's essentially what we're asking you to do. If there's any questions on.
Okay. Let's go to Joan Carlton of the FinCom.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of Article 17.
Bill Keller for the Selectmen.
The Selectmen recommend approval.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 17? Mr. Coe.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street.
I was the one who held the article from the consent calendar. And the reason that I did was because I think it goes after the wrong people. What we're doing here is we're hitting people that forgot to pay their tax bill or didn't notice the tax bill in the blizzard of junk mail that comes in, and finding a way to sock them with twice or three times whatever it was that they paid before. If we really are that down to that point where we have to nickel and dime people that way, why don't we instead go after the actual payment of the delinquent taxes? Because I will bet, and I'll ask the town accountant or the tax collector or whoever to enlighten us on this, but I will bet that if we went after the actual payment of the delinquent taxes, we'd get far, far more than we're going to get by doubling the demand fee for people that forgot to pay.
Thank you. Ms. Turkelson, could you just answer a question for me, please? Do you go after the tax delinquents? The answer is yes. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 17? Yes, sir.
Paul Pegas, 231 Knobscot Road. Do we have any idea of the demographics of the people that we're charging this fee to? Is it the poor seniors or the wealthy young ones? Or...
I'm not sure we haven't answered the question, but Ms. Turkelson, you may try.
I wouldn't say that we have those statistics anywhere in a database. The instance of delinquency crosses all demographics and all citizens of town, so it's not discriminatory by any means. If you don't pay your bill, you'll receive a demand fee and follow-up from me.
Yes, ma'am.
Laurie Abrams, 24 Goodman's Hill. Could you tell me how much money the town is saving by sending out, like, the third and fourth quarter payments, your tax notices at one time versus sending out each quarter separately? Because I'll tell you got me, and I'd be paying that, because when you send out every quarter or two quarters at a time, they get set aside, and now you're going to penalize us. So I'd like to know how much money the town is saving by sending out two quarter bills at one time.
Ms. Turkelson?
This is the first year that we've started that, and as a part of that, we've sent out several inserts and things and have done a lot of advertising, hopefully to get people accustomed to that twice a year billing for real estate. The demand fees in this case would also be on motor vehicle, which you typically receive one motor vehicle bill per year per vehicle. In terms of the real estate billing, we're saving in postage, printing, mailing, vetting of the bills, and this is the first year that we've had to do that, so we're still tabulating the costs on that, but expect to save approximately $4,000 to $5,000 a year by doing that.
Thank you. Perhaps I should have introduced you as the finance director, not as the tax collector. The motion that you see in front of you, could we put the motion on the view graph, is to raise the $5 fee to $10. So does anybody else wish to be heard on that before we can vote on it? Yes, sir.
Thomas Hollister, Concord Road. What is the actual cost currently to send out these demand notices? Are they more than the $5 fee or break even or what?
Is it more than the $5 fee, Ms. Turkelson, to mail out the demand notices?
Yes, it's a fee that continues to rise when you factor in the time it takes for the staff to create the bills, to vet them and so forth, cost of postage. Again, we're required by state law to send out demand bills. So this helps to pay for the cost of doing that. So postage, mailing, printing, and so forth adds up to more than the current $5 per bill.
Thank you. Okay. Ready for a vote. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. It passes by well more than the required majority. We're moving on to Article 18, Selectman Chair Keller.
Move to authorize the town manager, with the approval of the selectmen, to negotiate the terms of termination or use of the Wayland-Sudbury septage facility, including but not limited to the sale, transfer, use, care, custody, management, and or control of said facility, subject to the approval by the Board of Selectmen of the terms of any contract negotiated.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Keller?
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. The Wayland-Sudbury septage facility ended operations on December 1, 2009, following a lengthy process whereby the Boards of Selectmen of Sudbury and Wayland determined that even with significant expenditures of capital improvements to meet the permitting requirements of the Department of Environmental Protection, the aging facility, you all know it, it's on Route 20 just in between the two transfer stations, the aging facility had little chance of being able to be economically viable over the long term. As part of the shutdown process, the two towns need to decide how to conclude the existing intermunicipal agreement between them for operating this facility, including disposition of the plant itself, which sits on 7.63 acres of land owned by the town of Wayland and located at 490 Boston Post Road. This article would authorize the selectmen to sell all of the town of Sudbury's right, title, and interest in and to the septage facility to the town of Wayland. The current time, the two towns are working to determine the fair market value price of the treatment plant's depreciated value. At the current time, the two towns have located an appraiser with a background in valuing such facilities who will determine a value based upon the highest and best use and are developing the contract with the appraiser. Funds for his services will be paid out of the retained earnings of the facility. Following the appraisal process, the Sudbury Board of Selectmen will, if the value appears to be appropriate to us, enter into developing an agreement with the town of Wayland to buy out Sudbury's interest in this plant. Any funds received from such sale would go to Sudbury's general fund. Further, any funds remaining after all costs of paying the remaining long-term costs of the plant will be divided between the two towns. As a reminder, the parcel of land on which the treatment plant sits is located and has remained all throughout in the ownership of the town of Wayland, so that any future use of the land will be determined by the town of Wayland. However, the town of Sudbury, through the intermunicipal agreement with Wayland, which extends through 2017, has an interest in the facility and the parcel of land, which can either remain through the life of the agreement or be extinguished through the sale of Sudbury's interest to Wayland. Essentially, think of it as a lease. We have leasehold rights in effect, and we're not using the building any longer, and it would be appropriate to sell it off to Wayland at an appropriate price.
Thank you. Jamie Gossels, Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval.
Okay. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 18? Yes, sir.
Stuart Lovell, 58 Hudson Road. Has consideration been made of acquiring the site and using it for the potential future police station?
Using it for what?
It would appear to be an obvious candidate for use potentially in the future for the possible future police station.
Police station.
Okay. Much, let me just, if I can just flesh that out, much noise has been generated by town management about the lack of sites on Route 20 when they were dismissing that option, building a new police station on Route 20. And it seems an obvious question to ask, given that the price of land was brought up so often then. It seems an obvious question to ask whether consideration, at least consideration, was made of a fairly obvious thought, acquire the interest, acquire the land, given that Wayland presumably doesn't really want it.
Sir, I'm going to just have to rein you in here. The question before the hall is whether or not we should be selling our interest in the land in Wayland to Wayland.
I understand.
If you want to change that, should we buy it from Wayland? That would require an amendment that would be beyond the four corners of this article. So if you want to talk about whether or not we should sell our interest to Wayland, you may address that. But what you're doing now is going beyond the four corners of the article.
My question, I think, is not beyond the four corners of the article. My question is, was consideration made of that?
Terrific. Thank you. Selectman or Maureen, did anybody consider using this land or approaching Wayland to see if they would sell to us and allow us to build a police station there?
I guess I could answer by saying Wayland has informed us they already have plans for how to use this land. They were not interested in our suggestions for what they could do. It meets needs that they have.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 18? I see no one else. All those in favor of Article 18 signify by raising their cards. All those opposed. It passes actually unanimously. Article 19. We'll go to Lisa Eggleston of the Planning Board. Associate member
Associate
of the
member.
Planning Board.
Thank you. I'm
an engineer par extraordinaire.
I move in the words of the article.
Is there a second? There is.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. This article is presented as part of the town's ongoing compliance with its federally mandated NPDES Phase 2 stormwater permit, which regulates stormwater discharges under the Clean Water Act. If you recall, last year we passed a comprehensive stormwater management bylaw that established a permitting process and performance standards for stormwater discharges from various development and redevelopment activities in town. This bylaw, which is also required under our Phase 2 permit, is much simpler. It basically prohibits the discharge of anything but stormwater to our municipal storm drain system or to the water bodies that receive their discharge. There are some exempted non-stormwater discharges that are allowed. These would be things like firefighting flows and foundation drains. But basically anything that has the potential to contain pollutants is prohibited. These are termed illicit discharges. It is EPA's choice of words, not mine. And they are termed illicit because they are going into a storm drainage system that is not designed to treat them. Sources of illicit discharges might include sanitary wastewater, laundry discharges, or improper disposal of automotive fluids or household wastes. Put simply, we are responsible for what comes out of the town's storm drains. Therefore, we need to be responsible for what goes into them. In addition to complying with our federal stormwater permit, the objective of this bylaw is to maintain and protect the quality of the water in our rivers and streams by preventing pollutant discharge and to establish a mechanism for enforcement. The DPW director will be the authorized entity to enforce the bylaw, as that department is already responsible for investigating the storm drains for sources of contamination. This bylaw is the joint effort of the Planning Board, the Conservation Commission, Board of Health, and DPW department, and the language of the bylaw closely follows the state's model bylaw that's already been approved by the Attorney General's office. Recently, the town of Concord was fined by EPA for not regulating illicit discharges. It is our intent through this bylaw to avoid such penalties and to fully comply with the Phase 2 permit. The Planning Board and the Conservation Commission support this bylaw. We urge your support as another means of protecting our high-quality surface and groundwater resources in Sudbury. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It received a second, did it not? Yes, it did. Jamie Gossels for the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
Bill Keller for the Board of Selectmen.
The Selectmen oppose illicit discharges. and are in favor of this proposal.
Does anybody wish to speak in favor of illicit discharges? You do, sir. Oh, please, if you want to speak on this article, please stand.
My name is Frank Lyons, and I live in 157 Wayside End Road. I am president of the Hoprock Protection Association, which has been dealing with nutrient pollution in the Hoprock watershed, which is the primary cause of the nutrient pollution has been phosphorus and the effluent from the Marlboro Easterly Wastewater Treatment Plant. We have in this town 90 acres of ponds, which are hyper-eutrophic, which means they support plant life much better than they support animal life. And if they're not taken care of, they could become swamps. There are two sources for the pollution in that watershed. The nutrients from the Marlboro Easterly Wastewater Treatment Plant are one source, but the other source is stormwater discharge, the primary source. I wholeheartedly support this article, and I encourage everybody else to do so.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 19? Yes, could you stand, sir? Can we get your mic?
I'm Richard Bell, 24 Austin Road. I'm on the Sudbury Conservation Commission, and the Conservation Commission unanimously supports this article. We're supporting it not so much to comply with the EPA and DEP permits, but to protect our wetlands. In Sudbury, most catch basins ultimately drain to a wetland. Many of our wetlands act to filter and recharge groundwater in our aquifers. Our wetlands work hard to keep our water quality high. However, not all the pollutants can be removed by the processes that wetlands provide. Anything other than stormwater entering our town drainage system is illegal. Currently, there's no direct enforcement for illegal connections to our drainage system. This bylaw provides a mechanism for the enforcement. As part of the town requirements under our EPA and DEP permit, we will be establishing a system for identifying illicit discharges. Toxic pollutants and heavy metals can destroy habitat and affect aquatic organisms, impacting economic and public health. The detection and elimination of illicit discharges can result in significant reductions of these contaminants. Please, I'll thank you for supporting this amendment to our bylaws.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 19? Way in the back, please. Can we get a mic to that gentleman?
Thank you. John Donovan, Old Orchard Road. My concern at this past couple of weeks driving around town, I don't see any provision in there for people who are trying to, get rid of their indoor swimming pools called cellars at one time. Is there any penalty for pumping out your cellar, which ends up in the storm drains usually? It drains down your driveway into the road.
Ms. Eggleston for a response.
I had the same question because I'm doing the same thing. There is some pumps are not specifically listed as an allowed use, and that's because you are not allowed to permanently tie in your basement sump pump. They can oftentimes have floor drains, and there's not control over what goes into those. But one of the exempted discharges is groundwater, intercepted groundwater. And that's pretty much what we've been dealing with that we're pumping out. And I think for situations like that, that would absolutely not be considered a violation of this bylaw.
Thank you. Anybody else has a question or a comment? Yes, could you stand, please?
Susan Litowitz, 199 Concord Road. Does this article in any way address the residential use of pesticides, fertilizers, and herbicides?
Ms. Eggleston for an answer.
This article does not, in terms of residential use. Our phase two permit does. We do have a stormwater management plan where we are trying to educate the public about proper use of
pesticides, herbicides, and so forth. Also, the comprehensive stormwater management bylaw that we passed last year addresses it on any development or redevelopment project. It's very difficult to go back and regulate existing development or homeowners. But really, with something like fertilizers and pesticides, the best thing is to educate people on proper use, disposal, and storage. And it's really in everybody's best interest not to overuse the products, in part because we get our drinking water from within town, so we're contributing to our own problems if we overdo it there. It also costs more money to over-fertilize. And so I think that people can be educated in that.
Thank you.
It's not part of this bylaw.
Yes, sir. Could you stand up, and can we get a mic to this gentleman?
Glenn Merrill Skoloff, 18 Allen Place. I just have a question on Section 11 of this, which has to do with enforcement. It talks, and this is for the town attorney, I would imagine. The language seems sort of vague on enforcement. It refers to civil and criminal penalties as already provided for by law, and it talks about remediation and enforcement of remediation, et cetera. And I'm trying to, is it the director of the DPW that decides what that remediation is, or would court action be taken if someone isn't found to be in violation of this bylaw?
Lisa, do you have an answer for that? Just switch it.
Is that on?
Yes, it
okay.
is now.
I believe that what it says is that there can be injunctive relief, but the DPW director does have enforcement authority, and there is a fine that is levied in violations, and so that would be the first course of action would be to issue a citation and a fine, and hopefully things get resolved at that point.
Is the fine structure defined anywhere?
It's defined in the bylaw.
I don't see it in the warrant anywhere. Did I miss that?
I believe it's page 18. It is...
G.
Item G, non-criminal disposition. Town of Sudbury may...
First violation is $200.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard, or are we ready for a vote on Article 19? Apparently we are. Oh, a question over here. Yes, sir.
Robert Abrams, 24 Goodmans Hill Road. I hear that we're going to try and do things to encourage people not to over-fertilize or use too many pesticides and the like. But I don't see any thresholds at all in this proposed bylaw. So I don't know what over-fertilizing is, and I don't know what too many pesticides are. But what I do see in the article is that it's a violation to discharge any pollutants into the system. And the definition of pollutants under the article includes things like fertilizer and yard waste and animal waste and the like. And without any thresholds, although there are a lot of exceptions written into the bylaw in the exceptions section, none of the exceptions except the pollutants. So the way I read the bylaw under Section 7A, if you discharge any amount of any of these common pollutants, like fertilizer or animal waste or yard waste, into the system, then you're in violation. And there's no threshold, there's no exception. And so Mr. Donovan asked a question about your pump out your basement, and Ms. Ecclestone tells us that they have an exception for that. But when you pump it out, the water usually goes across your lawn before it gets to the street. It picks up fertilizer. The fertilizer isn't accepted. And I think what we have is that
in the effort to prohibit the illicit discharge of these wastes by wrongdoers, we've lost sight of how the average homeowner may end up being in violation without any intent. And there's no intent required by this article as well. Clearly, if somebody intentionally, wrongfully discharges some significant amount of pollutant into the system, they ought to be punished. But if the average homeowner inadvertently and unintentionally discharges some minor amount of something that is common but is defined as a pollutant, like fertilizer, there's no exemption for that. So it seems to me that what we ought to do with this is suggest that it go back to be reread by the people who wrote it, and I understand that not everybody who was involved in writing this is in this town. As somebody mentioned, the Attorney General's office approving it, and that's very nice, but I see a lot of lawyers in this room that spend a lot of time in court arguing with each other about what things that got written by the legislature mean. I can see some difficulties for us arguing about what some of the things that are written here mean. And I think it probably ought to go back and be looked at from what can be done to exempt any minor unintentional discharges of pollutants by ordinary homeowners. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Eggleston, are you able to answer Mr. Abrams' question or comment?
Well, I guess I would say that enforcement of any bylaw basically gives the enforcing agent some degree of discretion in what level of enforcement they will choose. I will also remind the hall that we, the town, hold a permit, the Phase 2 NPDES permit, that says that we are not allowed under the Clean Water Act to discharge pollutants from our storm drain system. So if we are allowing pollutants in and we are not treating them, then we are ourselves going to be in violation of the Clean Water Act. The objective of this is to alert people that they should not be allowing excess fertilizer to run off into the storm drains. This is coupled with an education program. Primarily, it focuses on direct discharges, things such as somebody hooking up a laundry waste or putting in an interceptor drain near a septic system that ties in and is picking up septic leachate. I would like to think that we could get to the point in our enforcement where our concern is excess fertilizer from somebody's lawn. I think we're a long ways away from that at this point.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard? Yes, there's someone standing up way in the back waving her hand.
I think this is on.
Yes, right. It is.
Rebecca Cutting, 381 Maynard Road. I agree with Mr. Abrams. I think this is a well-intentioned proposed bylaw, but it is both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. For example, we have a perfect example on Route 27 of a surface water discharge from a residential development. You pass it by if you're on your way to Maynard. It's a cut in Willis Hill, which discharges silt-laden stormwater into the town's system presently, and it is uncontrolled. There is nothing in this bylaw that talks about residential development. It focuses in the definition of pollutant as sewage, agricultural, which troubles me because it talks about agricultural runoff or leachate. So if you have an agricultural operation, which I hope we support, you could be subject to enforcement under this bylaw if your fields run off to the town's stormwater. system. I don't think that's what I mean by over-inclusive. And I agree with Mr. Abrams. I think it needs to go back to the drawing board. I support the concept, but I think it avoids the problems of residential development. I think that residential development should be included in the definition of pollutant. And I think that we should be very circumspect about the broad use of terms like runoff. Runoff is not defined in the bylaw. And as we all know, runoff could be something from your lawn, something from your surcharged septic system during a flood. And we all hope that the DPW director will exercise his discretion. On the other hand, he doesn't have to. So it's not well written. The other thing in pollutant is in item 9, it talks about rock, sand, salt, and soils. I would suggest that it should include silt, as I can testify that I have seen discharges from the town's stormwater system that have coated wetlands with silt, which means that vegetation and invertebrates, insects, salamanders, frogs, toads, which are all breeding now in this heavy rain, are not being protected. And it is true that stormwater contains high levels of phosphorus. As Mr. Lyons points out, in Hop Brook, it's from the Marlboro Westerly Treatment Facility, but it's also inherent in stormwater that it has high phosphorus content. This comes just from paved areas. As the town is developed, increasingly we'll have more stormwater and more phosphorus. It only takes a little bit of phosphorus, and it's in your dishwasher soap, as well as in your lawn fertilizer, to turn a pond into a slimy, algae-laden, eutrophic and useless water body. We've seen it. If you drive down Old Marlboro Road and look at the Meachin property, you'll see what was once a vernal pool with wood ducks and salamanders is now laden with algae. And that is not from road runoff, but from septic systems. So I support the planning board's efforts to reduce phosphorus. But I think this bylaw does not accomplish what it purports to accomplish. For example, she talks about, Ms. Eggleston talks about discharges. And one thing the whole needs to know is there's a difference between a point source in the EPA parlance, which is a pipe, a specific connection, and a non-point source, which is anything else. In other words, sheet flow across the street, across a lawn, across an agricultural field. So when you look at illicit connection, it says a surface or subsurface drain or conveyance. I'm not sure what they mean by a surface. Does it mean a surface drain? So that might be a ditch. That could be the ditch that conveys the flows from your sump pump. And then you look at illicit discharge. It talks about a direct discharge. That in the EPA parlance, again, means a pipe. But an indirect discharge could just be, again, a surface flow. So I urge the hall to return this bylaw back to the planning board for some better drafting.
Thank you. Before we get a response from Ms. Eggleston, is there anyone else who hasn't spoken or wishes to be heard? Did you want to be heard back there? Yes, could you stand up, please?
Thank you. As a retired scientist of 40 years...
John
Donovan, Old Orchard Road. As I said, as a retired scientist of 40 years in the lab, I find a problem with words like excessive. I like to see numbers. What is excessive? The previous speaker mentioned something about agricultural runoff. This is the least that I worry about. I mean, fertilizers, pesticides that are used in commercial operations for farms are figured on a dollar basis. Most homeowners just spread fertilizer and pesticides on the lawn. How many people, have calibrated their fertilizer spreader? They have no idea how much they're putting on. Whatever the number says, oh, set it on number 7. Well, that may be 5 times what you're actually getting. I think this bylaw needs a little bit better definition from a scientific standpoint.
Thank you, Ms. Eggleston.
Okay, well, if I can respond to a couple of the points that were made. First of all, Ms. Cutting was talking about a lot of what this bylaw does not do. It is not intended to be an all-encompassing bylaw. We passed last year a very comprehensive stormwater management bylaw that does regulate existing and new and redevelopment. So that is where a lot of the issues that were discussed get addressed. And, in fact, the property on Maynard Road, Maynard Road that you were referring to, is under enforcement order under that bylaw at present. So that's given us some leverage to actually take action against a situation that has been getting worse over the years. So just as that is one tool in our toolbox, this is another one. And again, I will remind you all that this is something that is mandated by EPA under our Clean Water Act. The requirement was actually to have an illicit detection bylaw prohibition in place by the end of the permit term that ended in May 2007. So we are at this point in violation of the permit that has been extended. As I said, Concord was fined last year specifically because they did not have an illicit discharge bylaw. So it is imperative that we do something very soon, or we are at risk of the same thing. This bylaw may not be perfect. It is a generic model bylaw that was used. It covers a lot of different types of discharges. There are places in the country where agricultural runoff is the primary source of pollution through large feedlot operations, and you can imagine the manure runoff and so forth, where that really does become a problem and a major source of nutrients and so forth. That's not the type of thing that's going to get enforced in this town. Really what we are looking to prohibit is anybody dumping waste oil down the drain, tying in the interceptors, as I said, with septic leachate, which is a primary source of both bacteria and nutrients to the Hopbrook system and various other water bodies. It's just another layer of protection. It's not intended to be all-encompassing.
Anybody who hasn't spoken yet wishes to be heard? What was the call of the question? Did I hear? Does that receive a second? It does. This is a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of the call of the question signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it receives well more than a two-thirds vote. We're on the main motion. You see it on the view graph. This is a majority vote. Hang on. A majority vote. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, oh, it passes well more than a majority. We're on to Article 20, Ms. Kablak. As is customary when we have multiple subsections, the Planning Board will make 5 separate motions. We'll discuss and vote on them separately. It's for the convenience of the hall. Each one requires a two-thirds vote. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Let's see. I didn't write this one down. I move to amend Article 9, the Zoning Bylaw, Section 2230, the Table of Principal Use Regulations, by adding an assisted care facility to use number C6 and amending the footnote number 2.2 in that section by reducing the front yard setback requirement for such uses from 150 feet to 50 feet.
Thank you. So receive a second. It does. Ms. Kablak, a question for the audience, if you could answer. These 5 separate motions, the substance of them, are they the same as what folks saw in the warrant?
Yes, they're exactly what was shown in the warrant.
Thank you. Why don't we go on with the first one?
Thank you. Jody Kablak, Director of Planning and Community Development, and I'm speaking on behalf of the Planning Board. As the moderator said, I'll be separating each minor amendment. And these are minor amendments, but we felt that they might be better clarified if they were spoken about individually. These are amendments that the zoning bylaw has been identified by various town departments over the past few years as being out of date or in need of clarification. The Planning Board does sponsor similar articles every few years, and in this manner, we have made the comprehensive zoning bylaw that we passed in 2001 a better document. These proposed changes do not significantly alter the intent of the major provisions of the bylaw, but they seek to clarify provisions and in definitions. So the First Amendment, and Mark, if you could put that one chart up, what I'm showing you is the actual chart that's in the zoning bylaw and the two places where we are proposing a change. And they're both highlighted. One is clearly in the middle of the page, and the other is way down on the right-hand side of the chart. This is the existing chart as is shown in the bylaw right now. This is Appendix A of the zoning bylaw, and we are proposing to add the words "and assisted care facility" in use number 6 and change the setback for front yards from 150 feet to 50 feet. The term assisted care facility is already defined in the zoning bylaw, but it does not appear as a use in the use table. The Planning Board over the years has considered the range of possible senior care options in town and feels that assisted living is missing as a permitted use in our zoning bylaw. We do have some experience with assisted living. The Orchard Hill facility on Route 20 at 761 Boston Post Road is a wonderful facility. It provides many services for town, and it does not seem like it's an undesirable land use. And the Planning Board feels that more facilities like this would be acceptable and that these facilities should be treated very similarly to nursing homes, and that's why it's added in the same line item. We're not proposing to change how these uses are permitted. They are currently permitted by special permit in residential zones as well as limited business zones, village business zones, and research districts. And all of the special restrictions that are pertaining to nursing homes would also apply to assisted care facilities, except for the front yard setback that we are proposing to be reduced. And so those include, there's a minimum lot size of 5 acres, there's a 50-foot front yard setback, 100-foot side yard setback if it's an abutting or residential use, and there are also restrictions on wastewater disposal. The changes to the front setback from 150 to 50 feet proposed brings these more in line with other similar commercial and institutional uses that are currently allowed in these districts. The 150-foot is extremely restrictive and is not warranted for any other use in our bylaw, even industrial uses. So we urge your support of this amendment.
Finance Committee, I assume, take no position on this?
That's right.
Thank you. Bill Keller for Selectman.
Selectman support the amendment.
Anybody wish to be heard on this first article motion that you see on the view graph? I see no one. This is a two-thirds vote, as all five are. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed, there's three negative votes. It's well more than two-thirds. Let's have the second one, Ms. Cadwalk.
Move to amend Article 9, the Zoning Bylaw, Section 2210, by adding the word residential after the words placed on A in the third sentence. So that section reads as follows: not more than one principal structure shall be placed on a residential lot, except in accordance with Sections 2300, Accessory Uses and Structures, 5300, SRC, and 5400, ISD.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Cadwalk.
Again, this is an even more minor insertion, which makes the bylaw more easily interpreted and enforced. And it comes about as a recommendation from the buildings inspector as a normal course of his review. And all it does is it differentiates between residential properties, which are restricted to only one principal structure, and commercial properties, which do not have the same limitation. And we urge your support.
Thank you. Finance Committee takes no position. Selectman?
Selectman support.
Anybody else wish to be heard on the second one that's on the view graph? Yes, could you stand, please?
Joseph Honorato, 2 Leanne Circle. I'd like to understand where in the bylaws the difference between the residential and commercial, institutional, and industrial classifications. It states that only the residential it is restricted to a single building on the lot.
Ms. Cadwalk?
Currently, there is no specific section that differentiates between those various land uses. But as we've seen over the course of many years, many commercial institutional sites have more than one principal structure on them. And I'll cite the case of the Sudbury Farms lot, which has the Sudbury Farms Plaza and Friendly's. It is believed that this is an intentional, was intentional that commercial structures did not have that same limitation.
So this is, in fact, a law that has never been enforced, and you're changing the law to conform to the practice. Is that right?
That could be. I don't know. I don't enforce the zoning bylaw.
Well, two things strike me, Ms. Cadillac, and please correct me if I'm wrong. One, that was probably a Zoning Board of Appeal case, and it could have been a variance. I don't know. And secondly, some of the older buildings in town could be grandfathered. Does that sound accurate to you?
That's correct, yes.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 20, this particular amendment? Yes, way back in the rear. Stand up, please.
Yes, John Donovan, Old Orchard Road. You mentioned residential and commercial property and auxiliary buildings, primary buildings. My concern is with farms and barns, structures like that. It's not addressed here at all, and I'm wondering what that's the same thing in Section 4. You mentioned sheds. I'm looking at animal sheds and things like that. A little more information on that would be helpful, Jody.
I believe that a shed and a barn would be considered an accessory structure, not a principal structure. And as well with farms, any farm that's over 5 acres is exempt from the zoning requirements, so wouldn't be subject to this restriction. But I believe that your primary use is your primary use, and I don't have my bylaw in front of me, which is your primary. If it's in a residential district, your primary use would be your residential use, and then your accessory uses would be anything else, storage of farm materials, storage of animals, and things like that. And I don't know if Jim Kelly's in the room. He might want to add to this. Okay. He says that's correct.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 20? Yes, sir. Stand up, please.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Not to nitpick, Mr. Moderator, but the word principal is misspelled in the second line. I wouldn't bring that up, except that the word principal is pretty key to this particular paragraph, so that probably ought to be fixed.
Okay. Ms. Cadillac, do you wish to change that in your motion?
Yes, I do.
Does the person who seconded okay that? Great. It's been changed. Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on this motion? I see no one else. All those in favor of the motion on the view graph, except it'll now be correctly spelled, please raise your hand. All those opposed, it is actually unanimous. It passes. Third one, Ms. Cadillac.
Move to amend Article 9 of the Zoning Bylaw, Section 2324, by adding the words "or other structures" after the word "trailers." So that section reads as follows. The temporary use of trailers or other structures for storage or office purposes is allowed where they conform to the procedural regulations adopted by the Board of Selectmen.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Cadillac?
This is another minor insertion into the bylaw. To allow the use of, for example, sheds or existing houses to be used for temporary storage or office purposes. And situations where this may happen is when either sometimes a house is being torn down and a new house is being replaced on that lot, and the owners wish to keep the existing house for temporary storage purposes until they can move into the house. That's one example. It also may occur when a larger property is being developed into a subdivision or senior housing, and that parcel of land has a house on it already, and then that house can be used for temporary purposes. Right now, the bylaw really only says trailers can be used for temporary purposes. Each instance requires the Board of Selectmen to receive an application, and if the duration of use is less than 3 months, a permit is granted administratively, and any temporary use greater than 3 months requires review and approval by the Board of Selectmen at a public meeting. And flexibility is the key to this amendment, and we urge your support.
Thank you. Finance Committee takes no position. Selectman, Mr. Keller?
The Selectman support.
Anybody wish to be heard on this particular motion? I see no one. All those in favor, raise your cards. Those opposed, it's another unanimous vote. The fourth one, please.
Move to amend Article 9, the Zoning Bylaw, Section 7000, Definition of Structure, by deleting the word fences from that definition so that it reads as follows. Structure, a combination of materials assembled to give support or shelter, such as buildings, towers, masts, sheds, roofs, storage areas, mechanical equipment, swimming pools, signs, but not including septic tanks and septic systems, and accessory facilities associated with the provision of utilities, such as drains, wells, transformers, and telephone poles.
Receive a second. It does. Ms. Cadillac?
Again, this is a recommendation by the building inspector. We do believe that a fence does not belong in the definition of structure, as it does not give shelter or support. And if a fence is defined as a structure, it would need to meet the zoning setbacks that other structures meet, which is in a typical residential zone, 40 feet from a front yard line, 20 feet from a side lot line, and 30 feet from a rear lot line. And as we all know, that's not the case. Most fences are just on the property line or just inside your property line. Again, we urge your support of this.
Finance Committee has no position. Mr. Keller for the Selectmen.
Selectmen, of course, supports a common sense recommendation.
Anybody wish to be heard? Yes, please. Could you stand?
Laura Abrams, 24 Goodman's Hill Road. Question. I thought that if you had a swimming pool, you had to put a fence around it, and swimming pools included, but you're taking fences out, so I'm just a little confused on that.
This does not change the requirement to put a fence around a swimming pool whatsoever.
Swimming pool is a structure, but fences aren't.
Right.
So you have a swimming pool, but then not a fence.
No.
A fence is no longer considered a structure, so that a swimming pool is subject to setbacks. The fence, if this passes, would no longer be subject to the setback. You could still have a fence. You could still have a swimming pool. Swimming pool would have to meet setbacks. The fence would not under this bylaw amendment. Anybody else wish to be heard? Could you stand, please?
Joseph Honorato, 2 Leanne Circle. If the fence is not a structure, how will it be classified? And could you explain what changes this change in the law make for permitting of them, for how a person should go about receiving a permit to put them up, if it's required at all, and what a neighbor can do if a fence is offensive? And I'll point out that there seems to be nothing in the bylaws, all 192 pages of it, that speaks to the issue of the type of construction of a fence that's allowed, how high it can be.
That's correct. There is no permit required for a fence currently in our bylaw, and this change does not change that whatsoever. In terms of putting up a fence on your property, I think there's common sense ways that you need to do that. You need to locate your property lines and then put the fence either on your property line or inside your property line. And maybe historically the selectmen might want to speak to that, as they are the fence viewers in town, which has some historical meaning. I'm not exactly sure what it means, but has to do with knowing where your property lines are. And maybe historically they were the arbitrator of such property line disputes. I think now most people have to go to court to resolve those. But this does not change. There's no permit required, and this does not require a permit for a fence.
Anybody wish to be else wish to be heard on this fence amendment?
I'll just comment. Excuse my voice, Mr. Moderator.
Yes,
I'll
go
just
ahead.
Comment on the fence viewer issue. Since my tenure on the Board of Selectmen, I can't recall a single time when we had a fence viewing incident. We've had plenty of dog incidents, but not fence viewing incidents.
Is that another example of the selectman falling down on the job? Oh, that was terrible. Anybody else wish to be heard on the fence amendment? That's before you on the view graph. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It passes by well more than a two-thirds. So Ms. Cadillac, for the last one.
Okay. Move to amend Article 9, the zoning bylaw, sections 4130 and 4143. To change the date of the National Flood Insurance Program firm flood insurance rate map and the flood boundary and floodway map for the town of Sudbury, community number 250217, from November 20th, 1998 to June 4th, 2010, wherever such date occurs in those sections.
Does it receive a second? It does. Ms. Cadillac?
Now, this final amendment, I have a feeling I'm going to get a lot of questions, and Bill Place is here to help me. But really all this does is change the date of to the most recent flood insurance maps that have been prepared by FEMA. These maps have been recently processed. The town has been given preliminary maps that indicate that June 4th, 2010 is the effective date. Our maps have not changed in any significant way. The flood boundaries are still the same boundaries that they were in 1998. And I'll say that in 1998, we did have some significant changes. Is that correct, Bill? In the 98 maps? Weren't there some changes? Okay. And the dates of these maps must be updated, or flood insurance under the federal program could be denied to Sudbury residents. So that's really the only impact of this, and we urge your support.
Finance Committee has no position. Selectman?
The Selectman support.
Anybody wish to be heard?
Yes, sir.
Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. Since June 4th, 2010 hasn't come yet, how do we know that there are going to be only minor changes to the June 4th map?
The draft maps have been on file with the town since November, I believe, with that effective date. So if the town does change this, unfortunately, we were only notified of this in, actually it was in December. It was right before Christmas, right before the warrant articles were due, and FEMA had sent us a fairly threatening letter that said, if you do not adopt this before June 4th, you could face the probability of your residents not being able to be eligible for the National Flood Insurance. And we had some exchange back with them, and we said, well, our articles are done. We've already submitted them to the warrant, and we agreed that we would just change the date for now. So the maps are on file. I believe it says that in the warrant as well. They've been on file at the engineering department for several months.
Thank you.
Anyone who has who wants to look at them could.
You all set? Ms. Gadlock, you done?
I'm all done.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on this final amendment under Article 20? I see no one. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It passes unanimously. Article 21. Eric Polk of the Planning Board for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. We move to indefinitely postpone Article 21.
Thank you. Is there a second? There is. Mr. Polk?
The Planning Board is postponing consideration for this article due to noted inconsistencies in the bylaw, which we became aware of after printing of the warrant, that may hinder the Zoning Board's administration of the bylaw and its role as special permit granting authority. We hope to correct these inconsistencies at a future date and would then consider bringing it to town meeting at a future date. The board would like to take the opportunity to thank the many residents who attended the meetings and public hearings on the article, who posed questions and voiced their concerns with expansion of wireless services through the various parts of town, which are currently not zoned for them. It was refreshing to actually see residents get involved in an issue, which we don't often experience. The resounding opposition to siting wireless facilities in their neighborhood definitely had an impact on the board's decision not to move forward on a vote this year. However, as we explained at the meetings, the decision of the board not to move forward does not, as we explained at the meetings, if Sudbury does not take action to determine where we want these facilities, we very likely will see them in places where we do not want them. Under the 1996 Federal Telecommunications Act, wireless facilities can be installed anywhere and trump local zoning bylaws. What experience in the last 12 years of this legislation has taught us is that if you provide zoning districts where they are allowed, most companies will locate there and avoid cost and time and lawsuits. However, if you do not, they will always win on appeal. This has proven itself to be the case across the country as well as locally, and is a very costly way to do business. Sudbury has always prided itself on being proactive rather than reactive. This issue is case in point. We were in the forefront of zoning for wireless facilities and have benefited from this. We have more than a dozen cell towers in town now, and most of them are completely invisible. The town collects approximately $100,000 a year from leases on two town properties. The Sudbury Water District benefits similarly. But more carriers want to enter the market, And there are known coverage gaps in different parts of town that they will try to fill. If we do not provide adequate coverage on legally zoned sites, they will locate them wherever they see fit. For more in-depth information on this, you can visit the Planning Board section of the town website, where you will see local coverage studies commissioned by the town, which was the guidance by which we proposed this article in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you. Finance Committee?
Finance Committee recommends indefinite postponement.
And that's recommending approval by the Finance Committee.
Yes.
Selectman?
Selectmen recommend approval of the indefinite postponement and look forward to the additional work to be done to bring it back.
Okay. Does anyone wish to speak on the motion to indefinitely postpone Article 21? I see no one. All those in favor, it's a majority vote. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes unanimously. Article 22 and 23 has been passed on by the consent calendar. We'll move on to Article 24, motion by Larry O'Brien.
Thank you, Mr. Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Moving the words to the article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Braun, come forward. Bill Braun will make the presentation on Article 24.
Bill Braun, 148 North Road, Chairman of the Sudbury Energy and Sustainability Green Ribbon Committee, or as I call it, the Energy Committee.
Bill, can you hang on one second? Were you thinking of moving the words of the article?
Oh, thanks. Yes.
Hang on one
second. I thought.
Hang on one second. Mark Thompson? Mark, do you have this motion in on your view graph? Can you put it up? And Bill, when you see it on the screen, could you read it? Thank you.
This is the change.
Could, no, move to amend. It's Article 24. Move
okay.
to amend. Could you read that, please?
Move to amend the first paragraph of Article 15 of the town bylaws entitled Building Code, by adding the words, including 780 CMR Appendix 120.AA, Stretch Energy Code, so that the paragraph reads, this article is replaced by the State Building Code, which is incorporated herein by reference, adopted under Chapter 802 of the Acts of 1972, including 80 CMR Appendix 120.AA, Stretch Energy Code, and the following sections.
That receive a second? It does. Mr. Braun.
Thank you. Thank you. Bill Braun, 148 North Road. The, as you know, our present building code bylaw has been in place since the early 1970s, simply accepts the Massachusetts State Building Code. We're now operating under the seventh edition of the state code, which has, for several years, included the Uniform International Energy Conservation Code. That code is updated every 3 years, and Massachusetts has committed to adopt the most current IEC into its building code. In May 2009, the Massachusetts Board of Building Regulations and Standards approved an alternative stretch code, energy code, as an appendix to the building code. The intent was to provide Massachusetts communities with a uniform option to take a more aggressive approach to improving building efficiency. This is part of a state and nationwide effort to reduce energy consumption and improve sustainability. The article for us just asked town meeting to amend our bylaw that adopts the state building code so as to include the stretch energy code. A little bit about the stretch code itself. Adoption of the stretch code is one of the five requirements under the Massachusetts Green Communities Act of 2008 to qualify for an annual $10 million in available grant money for energy-related activities. Sudbury is actively pursuing green community status. The green community funds can be used for a wide array of energy-related purposes, such as sustainable energy sources, building energy upgrades, like boiler replacements, thermal controls, more efficient windows, or for things like purchase of fuel-efficient vehicles, and so forth. So far, 106 Massachusetts cities and towns, including Sudbury, are receiving planning assistance to become green communities. 48 are scheduled to act on the adoption of the stretch code by the end of May, and all 8 who have taken action so far have adopted it. Those adopting communities, now I got to tell you, I don't know what qualifies as a peer community, but those adopting communities are Cambridge, Greenfield, Lexington, Lincoln, Lowell, and Newton. Other communities where adoption is in process are Acton, Brookline, Concord, Carlisle, Bolton, Hopkinton, Wayland. A substantial number of Massachusetts communities are in the process of trying to participate in this. What does it affect or how does it apply? It applies to residential and commercial new construction, as well as in principle additions or remodels, but in effect does not impose any increased requirements on additions or remodels because they typically would use prescriptive measures that are already specified in the 2009 International Energy Conservation Code, which is in its phase-in period between January and July of this year. It's important to note that a number of building types are exempt from the stretch code, including any existing structure, assuming it's not being modified, and historical buildings. As with present and previous building codes, there's no requirement to bring an existing structure up to the new code at any time, so long as it's, again, not being worked on. The stretch code uses the Home Energy Rating System, or HERS, as the index of building efficiency. This system is developed and administered by the Residential Energy Network, Energy Services Network, which is a national standard-setting body. The rating is based on calculated and measured energy efficiency, including performance tests for key items like building tightness and duct integrity. Many new homes in Massachusetts are now being built using Energy Star standards that are now reflected in the Massachusetts Energy Code. The stretch code increases new home energy efficiency by 15 to 20 HERS index points over that standard. Just so we know sort of what is involved here, the things that affect building energy efficiency and the resultant HERS rating are all sort of common sense items, including the resistance of the building envelope to airflow and conductive thermal transfer, the efficiency of energy-consuming devices like lighting, HVAC, and appliances. Use of sustainable energy sources also improves the rating. What's important is that the stretch code requirements can be met using existing and readily available technology, materials, and techniques. The major effect on the building process is that new construction will go through the HERS rating process, which begins at the design stage and ends with final performance testing and the issuance of a rating certificate. This entails engaging a certified HERS rater who performs initial energy modeling of the design, conducts various inspections, carries out performance testing, and issues a rating certificate. As I mentioned, most additions and remodels will use the prescriptive option, which is equivalent to the Energy Star Builder's Option Package and is specified in the now current 2009 IECC. The HERS process itself, this slide shows a synopsis of it, it has an emphasis on in-process checks, and the purpose of that is to ensure the likelihood of success in attaining the rating. Again, the high leverage items all relate to leak sealing and proper installation of insulation. Say that 10 times quickly. The cost impact is, as we've mentioned, over and above the newly adopted 2009 IECC, is mostly going to occur to new construction. It will increase the upfront cost. Models estimated at about $3 per square foot over the reference home, which, don't forget, would comply with the now obsolete IECC 2006. The incremental cost to build a house to the new code would obviously, therefore, be less than the $3 a square foot additional. But, again, if you carry the model through, reduced energy costs and incentives actually result in a net positive cash flow, that is a net reduction in annual amortized costs. Impact on the town, the cost impact of the town is expected to be neutral to slightly favorable in that no significant additional demand is placed on the building department, and the third-party plan review, field inspections, and testings that would occur with new construction may relieve some of the effort now required to ensure energy code compliance. I think what we worry about most in town meeting, as evidenced from some of the prior articles that came up, is the impact on Sudbury residents. And although some current residents obviously build new homes in Sudbury, arguably the main effect on current residents would be felt in the higher cost of an addition or remodel of an existing house. Given that these would follow the, typically follow the prescriptive path, the stretch code doesn't produce any additional impact over the new base code. It can also be argued that, in the present energy environment, the incentives for higher rather than lower energy efficiency are very strong. There are a number of issues and concerns that at least in principle could arise. First of all, no one wants more regulation, but in fact, this does not amount to additional regulation. It's just different. Energy codes have been with us for some time and serving an increasingly important purpose as environmental concerns develop. It's also been mentioned that adopting a more stringent building energy code will put Sudbury at a competitive disadvantage with respect to other communities. The opposite effect is equally likely, and either way, we'll have plenty of good company. There could also be concern about increased upfront building costs, but in the present environment, ongoing operating costs are at least as important as initial investment, and the stretch code measures, by all assessments, should produce a favorable return on that on the investment to implement them. Builder familiarization with the new code and associated process will be required, but that occurs with any code change. Much of the required learning is now ongoing for the new base energy code, which is, in fact, a significant change from the prior code. There are a number of training programs and other resources available, and we can expect energy codes to continue to tighten so the learning effort is well spent. With respect to additional complexity, the HERS system and Energy Star measures lay out a reasonably clear path to meeting energy efficiency targets. Lastly, with respect to issues and concerns, it's been brought up that there are too many codes, and that will cause confusion because different towns will have different codes. Well, in fact, the intent was to make this a uniform option, and towns will, in fact, have one of two uniform building codes, either the base code, which is now, as I mentioned, the International Energy Code of 2009, or the stretch code. If Sudbury doesn't adopt the stretch code, we'll still be different from towns that have, so being different is not necessarily an issue. The rationale for adoption, I think, is pretty clear. It acts on our town's values to be environmentally responsible and promote energy efficiency and sustainability. Importantly, it provides access to Green Communities funds, which will help us further increase our energy efficiency and curtail our energy costs. There's no meaningful incremental cost to the town, and this thing will become the standard code probably in the next iteration of the IECC. So does not seem to be a bad thing for anybody, and it's a good thing for most people. It looks like more energy-efficient housing is probably a win for everybody, so that's our we urge your support for this.
Thank you. Finance Committee has no position on this article. Thank you. Selectman?
Unanimous support.
Thank you. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 24? Yes, sir.
Now, not to nitpick, Mr. Moderator, but is it 80 CMR or 780 CMR? The motion says 80 CMR, and the warrant and all of the other material we were shown tonight says 780 CMR.
780, thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 24? I see no one. All those in favor, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes unanimously. We'll move on to Article 25, Selectman O'Brien for the motion. Selectman O'Brien for the motion.
Yes, Mr. Moderator. Move that the town authorize the town manager and selectmen to negotiate and or contract with a company or companies to provide renewable energy facilities at the town landfill site and to enter into long-term leases and or contracts, including power purchase agreements, of greater than 20 years, and to further authorize the selectmen to petition the Great and General Court to authorize the town to enter into long-term leases, contracts, including power purchase agreements greater than 20 years without submission to a further town meeting.
Can I receive a second? It does. Mr. O'Brien?
Thank you. As the town has pursued opportunities in lowering our overall operating expenses, energy is an area where we spend a great deal of money each year, and the town is interested in developing sources of renewable energy to lower these energy costs. And in addition to that, this motion will allow us to take advantage of available federal, state, and private incentives and to act responsibly with respect to the global environment. The primary idea that we have that we've put forth here is essentially to build or to contract with a company that would build a large, approximately 2.5 megawatt photovoltaic array on top of the 17-acre capped landfill. And it's important to note that the landfill, due to the fact that what the landfill was made of, has very little, if no, solid ground that you could build much of any sort of structure on, like buildings or anything of that sort. So what you can do with the landfill is, because it is capped, build something on it that would be fairly lightweight and stationary. Photovoltaic cells would be a logical option. People have raised the question, what about wind turbines? You have to go too deep to set those, and you would puncture the lining. So that's not part of the renewable energy cost of the renewable energy sources that we're considering here. The nature of the industry itself is one where there's a rather significant upfront cost, and there are no federal or private or state incentives to communities to fund these sort of enterprises, but there are in the private sector. So allowing approval of this article this evening would allow for the town to enter into long-term contracts. We would need to enter into contracts greater than 20 years. That is why we would want to petition Beacon Hill to grant us that authority through a Home Rule Act. And in doing so, we would be able to contract with a company that would generate electricity, sell it back to us at a very competitive market rate. And at the end of the 30 years, depending on how the contract was negotiated, we may even own the equipment outright. But it puts us in a position where, by doing this, we can gain better control over our long-term energy expense. It's responsible to the environment, and it also allows us to meet one of the requirements to become one of the to gain green community status under the 2008 Green Communities Act that Mr. Braun just referred to in the prior article. We think this is an excellent idea that can be done as a public-private sort of a joint enterprise, and we look forward to your support and being able to be responsible environmentally and also economically.
Thank you. Finance Committee?
Finance Committee unanimously supports this article.
The Finance Committee supports the article. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 25? Yes, could you stand up, please? Can we have a mic out in front here? Mr. Coyne, that's you. Thank you very much for helping out.
Adam Miller, One Knob Scott Road. I was wondering, you know, given that this is sort of a long-term commitment of that space, what other consideration or study has been done to alternate uses of the landfill space? Because, you know, we often hear that there, you know, aren't enough playing fields in the town, and I really, you know, I didn't know if that had been analyzed as an option for the landfill space, because I feel it would be, if it was stable enough for such a use, that would be an appropriate use rather than occupying other fields, which, in my opinion, would rather be more appropriate staying in agricultural uses rather than put into playing fields. So I don't know if...
Thank you. Mr. O'Brien?
Yes, the topography of the landfill, if you know it, it's multi-layered and would take a tremendous amount of work and effort to become suitable for playing fields and a rather significant investment. We think that this is a very cost-effective way of using that 17-acre parcel in a way where the funding to generate this would come from outside sources. And those sources, for anyone that's trying to do the math in their head, those private enterprises then turn around and receive the federal grants and the tax credits, et cetera, and that's how it becomes cost-effective for them to do it. Those are programs that are not available to municipalities. So by partnering with them, they put the money up front and they make the money back through the programs that are available and the sale of the electricity is generated. The only other item I can say, Adam, that's been put forth over the years, and it was very limited proposal, was to possibly turn the landfill into a driving range. And there's a driving range in Marlboro that went out of business a couple of years ago, so it never really received much serious consideration.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard on 25? Yes, sir.
Michael Fee, Henry's Mill Road, Chairman of the Planning Board. And what I'm about to say, I do with some discomfort, because the Planning Board is very much used to working hand in glove with the Board of Selectmen on all types of warrant articles of this nature. And I have to report to you that the Planning Board takes no position on this article because we weren't consulted. And to your point, Adam, I think it's this is the type of article that the Planning Board might have wanted to weigh in on with respect to alternative uses. I don't know why that is. Certainly it's inconsistent with our methods of interacting with the Board of Selectmen. And it may be in terms of timing or whatever that this needed to get done without our input. But nonetheless, I would just note for the hall the language in this proposed article that troubles me, and that is in the third line where it states that the town manager is authorized to provide, quote, renewable energy facilities at the town landfill. And what's troubling to me about that language is that it's broad. There are a variety of different types of uses that qualify as renewable energy generators, some of which are benign and some of which are not. Certainly the use of solar energy at this site would be appropriate in my mind. Certainly wind, if it was feasible, would be another use that I think would make sense. But renewable energy facilities also include things like biomass, which are wood-burning facilities that are hugely controversial and could create environmental impacts that go far beyond what we are contemplating here. So my point is if the Board of Selectmen would consider amending this to change the word renewable energy facilities to photovoltaic or solar facilities, I think that would resolve my issue with the language.
Mr. Fee, what is that language? Instead of renewable energy facility, you would change that to what?
Solar facilities.
Solar facilities.
Okay.
We're still going to comply with green communities? Can I ask the question to Mr. Braun concerning the green community? Bill, in terms of the Green Community Act, if we were to amend this to limit it to solar only, would that disqualify us from meeting one of the requirements to become a green, to be classified as a green community?
I can't answer that definitively, but I would surmise in real time here that solar or photovoltaic qualifies as a under the rubric of renewable energy source. It's just not as broad, but it certainly would qualify under the the criteria that the Green Communities Act would establish. Thank you.
Excuse my voice again. Just a clarification for Mr. Fee. One, from a geotechnical perspective, there'd be no way that we could construct the foundations for a biomass facility at the landfill. And then secondarily, more important, the state of Massachusetts does not allow biomass facilities within the state, and there's been a long uphill battle to permit new biomass facilities, and the state has a ban on biomass facilities in the state of Massachusetts. But I have no problem with the amendment as long as we qualify the Green Community Act.
Mr. Braun.
To be clear, it probably would not be prudent to tie it to photovoltaic, but I think tying it to solar, limiting it to solar, would satisfy the objection and still work.
Okay, you all set with that, Mr. Fee? Solar.
Just inserting the word solar after the word renewable would do the trick.
So it would be
renewable solar energy facility.
That's what you would like to say.
The board has no objection to that.
Mr. Fee, would you like to make an amendment, please? Why don't you say it before you write it, even though that's contrary to my policy, just to get things moving here.
Thank you, sir. Move to amend Article 25 to insert the word solar after the word renewable in the third line of the article.
Does that receive a second? Thank you very much. Are you writing there, Mr. Fee? Anybody wish to be heard on that? Yes, sir. This is on the amendment to put the word solar in front of renewable.
Actually, my comment is on Frank Lyons, the Wayside Inn Road. There's another word missing on the fourth line, energy facilities. It should be at or on the town landfill.
Okay.
There's a preposition missing.
How do you like at? He's going to put that in his amendment. The person who made that second would accept that? Thank you very much. The word at. So for those of you who didn't hear, we're going to put the word solar, provide solar renewable energy facilities at the town landfill. It's not up there. It's not up home. It's not up there. Okay? That's what everyone's looking at. He might have read it. It's not up there. We're going to add it.
Okay.
Anybody else wish to be heard on this amendment? Selectman, you're okay with it? Planning board's okay with it? Yes, sir. Stand up, please. Mr. Coyne, way in the back. No. Hang on for the mic. Coming at you.
The question I have is, what is it says renewable solar energy. I wonder what that implies about non-renewable solar energy and whether it makes sense to leave the word renewable in there at all.
Okay. Mr. Brawny wants to delete the word renewable. What do you think? Just say yes or no. No objection there. Selectmen care about that? No. Mr. Fee? We're thinking, Mr. Fee, are you okay with that? He wants to delete the word renewable. Just say solar energy. Great. That's part of your amendment. Is the person who made the second okay that? We got it. Okay. No more renewable. We're replacing with the word solar, and we're adding the word at. Anybody else want to make any more deletions or additions? I see none. Anyone want to ask any questions about the amendment? I see none. Does anybody want to wait for the writing, or this is simple enough to vote on it? Very good. All those in favor of the amendment, please signify by raising your cards. Thank you. All those opposed, it's actually unanimous. Now we're going to go on to the main motion that is now before you, right there. This is the main motion. Unbelievable, Mark. That was terrific. Anybody wants to be heard on the main motion? I see. Yes, sir. Ma'am. Excuse me. Coming around. Mr. Coyne, thank you. I just need a name and address and then your comment.
Abby Miller, 1 Upscott Road. I wonder, since the planning board didn't get a chance to weigh in with this question about if this is the best use for this land or if there's some other, it seems like the planning board maybe should have been involved in making this decision about whether the town landfill is best used for a solar energy site or some other use. I'm wondering if we should maybe not make this big decision to use it for 20 years for solar landfill until...
May I ask that question of the planning board?
Yes.
Mr. Fee.
I have the utmost respect for the judgment of the selectmen. I'm sure that they're bringing this forward at this time because they have a valid reason for it. Certainly the planning board would have liked to have been part of that process. But given what we have before us, I think the consensus on the planning board is that we're comfortable with it.
Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to be heard on the main motion on the view graph? I see no one else. All those in favor of the main motion? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Lyons. Okay, we'll get you next. Thank you.
Frank Lyons, Wayside Inn Road. I have a question. My understanding is that there are pipes at the landfill that were used to deal with methane. Is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Lyons, there are pipes at the landfill deal with methane. They're only at that location where you see the white fence along Route 20. The rest of the landfill does not have pipes. I think the issue with the landfill is not good foundation material, so that the potential uses there are somewhat limited. And this article does not preclude other non-heavy uses, but it just gives it the opportunity to take a look at. So there's no infrastructure that would impede any development there.
I'm not sure I heard all of that, but is there potential to get some methane energy out of this by further development?
I would say, based on the volume of solid waste in the landfill and studies that the town of Wayland has shared with us on their methane generation, that the likelihood of generating a sustainable energy source of methane from the landfill is not a viable option.
Thank you. And there was a question back there, sir, or a comment.
McDonald, Aaron Rowe. Just a quick question. This article that's up on the board here, that automatically obsoletes what's in the warranty?
Yes.
So different.
Yes.
Yes. Anybody wish to be heard on this Article 25 main motion as it has been already amended? I see no one else. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed. Article 25 passes. A question for the hall. You have the choice of staying here for one more article, which would require a two-thirds vote, in which case we'll probably finish tomorrow night, or we can go home and we probably won't finish tomorrow night. Your choice. Does someone wish to make a motion? I'm sorry, there was a motion in here. What was that motion first? Move to adjourn. Second, all those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. We're going to try it one more time. Those in favor of the motion to adjourn signify by raising your cards. Those opposed. It passes. We'll be that motion was to adjourn to tomorrow night at 7:30. Is that correct? Thank you very much.